It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat, delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Happy 4th of July weekend. This is episode 502 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, July 2nd, 2017. I am the Sala Monster. Happy 60th birthday to my favorite wrestler. If I had to pick one favorite wrestler of all time, Bret the Hitman Hart turning the big 6-0 today. I was just watching Bret Hart against Doink the other day. I've been on like a SummerSlam kick. So I was watching SummerSlam 93, which was supposed to be Bret against Lawler. They were in the middle of their big feud, the beginning of their big feud, which went on for like 2 years. So, Lawler came out pretending to have been in a car accident. He's on crutches. And so they have Doink the Clown out there against Bret Hart. You would think, you know, what a ridiculous match, right? Bret Hart against this guy in clown makeup. They had a damn good match. I mean, that's a whole other story about how underrated, I think, that original Doink character was. But he and Bret Hart, you know, they had a pretty good match. And then, Lawler, of course, hits him with the crutch. So Bret wrestles a second time against Lawler. And it was just great. It was really great stuff, as a lot of Bret's stuff was back then. I'm a big, big fan of his, mostly from that period, from like 92 to 94. I mean, his best year was 97 in terms of the stuff that he was doing. Maybe not even so much in the ring, just the whole thing and the Hart Foundation and the heel turn and the promos. But that 92, 93, 94 period, Bret cranked out a lot of great matches and was really, in a lot of ways, carrying that company on his back. You know, I think he probably got more over than most people expected him to. And he did a hell of a job. And that was right in that sweet spot where there wasn't always a whole lot of really interesting stuff going on at the time in WWF, but I always dug Bret stuff, and he kept me a fan. So, happy birthday to the Hitman. It was a week where the women in WWE headline Raw, headline SmackDown, and headline NXT. Back to back to back. All in the same week. I don't know that that's ever happened before. Not only did they headline each of those three shows, they headlined in long main events. This was not like, these were not 3 or 4 minute throwaway matches. These were long main events, all of which I would say were at least good, if not very good in some case. In fact, if I had to rank them, I would rank the last woman standing match on NXT first, then the gauntlet on Raw, and then the Money in the Bank match on SmackDown. But they were all good. So we're going to talk a lot about that. We also learned, speaking of things from this week, we also learned, according to Jerry Lawler on his podcast, I have to fit this in here, because otherwise I don't know where I would mention this, but he has a podcast now, it's called like Dining with the King, where he's at his restaurant in Memphis, and he basically is on the phone doing a podcast from there. And he claims that he made $130,000 for his match with Michael Cole at WrestleMania 27. $130,000 for that match. They should have paid us $130,000 for having to sit through that match. I was astounded by when I read that. And, you know, I actually felt bad for him, too, because, you know, he couldn't have been happy with that match. I mean, he wanted a WrestleMania match for so many years. And, you could even listen to him in interviews after the fact. He wasn't exactly enthralled with how that match went. And I kind of felt bad for him, like, oh, after all these years, you know, a legend in the business, he's been in the company for so long, and that's the WrestleMania match they give him. I don't feel bad for him much anymore. I think, $130,000 for that, it's not bad. I'll be somebody you could toss out of the Andre Battle Royal. You could throw me into the fifth row if I can get half that. So anyway, I was kind of amazed by that number. I probably shouldn't be. I mean, if you think about it, that was one of the more heavily promoted matches on that show. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what happens the day of. It's all about, you know, how many people are in, like, what matches are people most interested in going into the show? What matches will lead to people buying the show? I don't know how many people bought that WrestleMania just to see Jerry Lawler against Michael Cole, but that was one of the more heavily promoted matches on that show. So, realistically, it's not that shocking. It's just, it would have been nice if they would have had a better match. In any event, Audible continues to be a great sponsor here for the podcast, and you guys have been taking advantage of your free Audible trial using our link, audibletrial.com/solemonster. This is a good time to do that because Justin Roberts' book, which was kind of stuck in purgatory for so long, is now officially on Audible and narrated by Justin himself, I believe over 11 hours worth of audio. His book is called Best Seat in the House. It is a detailed inside look at what it is like to work in WWE. It's his journey, really, from being a fan as a kid to where he is today, having to fight and work his way up. But the stuff about the inner workings of WWE and dealing with people like Kevin Dunn and Vince McMahon and people like that, it's very, very fascinating. It is by no means a book where he just trashes people and stuff. You know, I saw some early reviews for the book. People cherry pick, you know, the really interesting stuff from it. But I think it's a very balanced, very fascinating and also maddening. And if you read the book, you'll know what I'm talking about. A maddening look at the inner workings of that company. I encourage everybody to check it out. I'm just about done with it myself. But if you want to hear Justin narrate it and you want to get it for free, you can use our link, audibletrial.com/solemonster. Get the 30-day trial. You got to sign up. But you will not be billed unless you cancel your trial before the 30 days are up. And if you do so, you still get to keep your book absolutely free. And it could be Justin Roberts. It could be the AJ Lee book, Crazy Is My Superpower. It could be Daniel Bryan's book, Shawn Michaels' book, Chris Jericho, Brock Lesnar, Stone Cold, Hulk Hogan. I mean, my God, anybody and everybody. It's a who's who. All these books are available. You can pick one and get it for free. So definitely take advantage of that offer. If you want to make a PayPal donation to the show, $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. You can do so on thesolemonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. I want to say thank you to our VIPs this week, including John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, The Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra, Ladies Man Levi Daly, Massgrave Micah Harshaw, The Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, Kind of a Big Deal Corey Blake, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Raymond the Mountie Medina, the Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog, who celebrated a birthday this past week, as did his son David, who just turned 4 years old, so happy birthday to the both of them. We have the Sibling Psychos, the Bakersfield Brawler Kevin Velotto and Max the Axe Velotto. Thank you very much for your generous donations. Gemstone, Julie Rabb, Stuart Bruiser Brody, Cool Guy, Curtis Daniels, Cody Heartbreaker Hatch, The Main Attraction, Jackson Scott, The Mississauga Missionary, Steve Kenny, The Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, Better Than Raw, Robert Michalshek, Stephen Handyman, Halistic, Gladiator, Gary Hauserman, The Columbus Destroyer, John Sterniker, The Masked Coward, thank you very much, and also, last but not least, Luis, the Belmont Sentinel Alejandro. You can check out his YouTube channel, The Luis Belmont Show. It's got walkthroughs and TV reviews, as only Luis can do them. You can check it out on youtube.com/Luis Belmont Show. One more quick note here, and we are going to talk about New Japan, because I had a chance to watch night one of G1, the G1 special in the USA last night. Talk about that in just a second. But Carl Fisher, listener of the show, is opening an MMA and wrestling academy with an amateur Olympic wrestling charity that trains former gang members, as well as abused and disadvantaged teens and young adults. They also offer them a bed and a hot meal, counseling sessions, and a paid-for NVQ course in any subject they like. He has just launched a crowdfunder page. They're trying to raise, I guess, £200,000 to purchase equipment, to hire staff, buy insurance. So if you think you like that cause, and it sounds like a pretty good cause, if you want to help, the crowdfunder is called Wrestle Club Pro Academy. They have a website up. You could search for it. Or you can contribute directly if you'd like via PayPal after you scope them out. Info at wrestleclubpro.co.uk. So as I mentioned, New Japan Pro Wrestling is trying to break through here in the U.S. And they had their first night. It's actually two nights. Night two is tonight. But night one of their G1 special in the U.S. last night, live from Long Beach. I want to say thank you to the folks over at Access TV for hooking me up with a link to watch the show live last night, since I do not have Access Television through my cable provider. Shame on them. So thank you to Access for the hookup. I was very amused before the show started to see, of all people, Roseanne Barr, or whatever her last name is. Now, I still call her Roseanne Barr, but Roseanne, who, by the way, Roseanne is coming back to TV. I don't know how many of you saw that. That show, that sitcom, has actually become kind of a favorite of mine in reruns. I remember back when I was a kid, like, my mom used to watch it, not necessarily every week. So I saw, like, a good number of Roseanne episodes, and I can't believe I'm going on a Roseanne tangent here during a New Japan review, but that's the way it is. But the one thing I will say that I used to really enjoy about that show, they used to kill it with their Halloween episodes. Somebody on the, I don't know if it was Roseanne or somebody who worked for the show, must have been a huge, like, horror fan or Halloween fan. They were so creative. Every year, their Halloween episodes and the stuff they would do and the gags and everything else, it was so awesome. And that, I think that show was on for like 7 or 8 seasons, and it got really stupid, I think, by the end, because they hit the lottery, and it was really dumb. But Roseanne has been greenlit, because what's old is new again, and so now the television networks and Netflix and all these different things, all they're doing is really rebooting old shows left and right. Full House came back as Fuller House. There's other ideas, I think, that are in the pipeline. I'm still waiting for somebody to reboot Perfect Strangers and bring back the original duo. I'd watch that. But Roseanne's coming back with the original cast, John Goodman, who who died at the end there near the on the original. So that'll be interesting if they just ignore that. I guess they kind of have to, unless it's the ghost of John Goodman. But it's coming back to ABC. I'm actually looking forward to that. I want to see what they do with it. But she apparently is a New Japan fan. She was tweeting out photos of her and her family at home watching New Japan on Access TV. So that's pretty cool. I thought it was a good show overall. I was pleased with it. Went a little long. It started at 8 and it ended around 11:30. So what is that? 3.5 hours. The second show, which actually it's taking place tonight, but it's not airing on Access until this Friday, is, I know in the press release they said that would be a 4-hour-plus show. So I wish the length was a little less, but overall it was not, I was not displeased with how I spent my time last night, but it was not without its issues. It had production issues, the announcer mics, you had Jim Ross and Josh Barnett. On commentary, the announcer mics kept popping, and they kept cutting in and out. They had these abrupt cuts to commercial, like you would see at the end of a round in a UFC fight, which always annoys me. So they had constant, like at the very end of the match, they would abruptly cut to commercial. But the key there is, it was at the end of the match. I don't recall there being any commercial breaks. Maybe there was, but I don't recall there being any commercial breaks taken during any of the matches themselves. And I have to say, it was refreshing to not have ad breaks in the middle of the matches themselves and these predictable, you know, the predictable formula that we're so used to seeing on WWE television, where somebody gets thrown out of the ring or both guys get knocked out and you're just waiting, right? You're just waiting for Michael Cole or Tom Phillips to be like, you know, Raw rolls on, SmackDown rolls on. And they cut to commercial. We didn't have any of that nonsense. So you know what? If the abrupt cutaways at the end was the consequence of not taking ad breaks during the matches, then you know what? I could live with that. Jim Ross and Josh Barnett, as I mentioned, they were the announce team. Let me just say this. I love Jim Ross. I think that he is the greatest play-by-play wrestling commentator of all time. And I'm a big fan of, you know, growing up, of other voices. Even Vince, I didn't think was a terrible play-by-play guy. It was his product. Nobody was more passionate about it than he was. He had a certain announcing style. Gorilla Monsoon, I was a big fan of his. You know, some people grew up on Gordon Solie. I was never really a big Gordon Solie fan, but again, I didn't grow up on his voice. So I'm a Jim Ross guy, through and through. I would take a subpar JR over most other announcers today. But this was not his best night. He misidentified a whole bunch of people. I know at one point he confused Bushi with Evil. He called Zack Sabre Jr. Will Ospreay at one point, which he actually did apologize for when they came back from commercial. He and Josh Barnett both didn't seem to know the name of Jay Lethal's finish when he won with it in his match against Hangman Page. It's the Lethal Injection. They just called it a springboard cutter. Didn't seem to have any concept of what the name of the move was. JR seemed to forget the rules of the match. Later on, they had the IWGP Tag Team title match with War Machine, which was made no DQ right before the match. They did a promo in the ring. They made it no disqualifications. And as they approached the end of the match and people ran down, chairs were involved and whatnot, he seemed to forget the fact that it was a no DQ match. There were a few other things too, but those are the ones I just jotted down. It's going to be very interesting to see, I think, how he does with Lita, because he's going to be the main announcer for the Mae Young Classic next month. And it's going to be very interesting to see how he is there and how he and Lita... And I never looked at Lita as being this strong announcer. I know she's done it before, but to see him and her together doing that, coming off this performance, which was not his best, is going to be very interesting. And there were a lot of people on social media saying the same thing. Some people were a lot more harsh. I'm not going to be overly harsh because there's something about hearing Jim Ross and his voice on commentary that just makes it feel special. That has not changed. It kind of feels like a big deal. And I don't have a chance to see the New Japan shows that they do weekly. Maybe if I heard this week after week after week, it wouldn't feel as special, but I don't get to hear JR doing commentary very much. So when I do, it still feels like a big deal. But again, not his best night. We had, just to run through the results here and some thoughts mixed in, Chaos, which was Will Ospreay, Roppongi Vice, Mark and Jay Briscoe, against Bullet Club, Marty Scurll, who JR kept calling Shirl, so I will assume that is the correct pronunciation, that it's Shirl and not Skrull. The Young Bucks, Bad Luck Fale, and Yujiro Takahashi. The Bucks were going for the Meltzer driver, but Will Ospreay broke it up. Rocky Romero then pinned Matt Jackson with a roll-up. I thought this finish came out of nowhere. They didn't give these guys a whole lot of time. I guess they just wanted to whet your appetite here in the opener. But yeah, the finish, I was not ready for that finish. It kind of came out of nowhere. That was a little disappointing. But the rest of the action was just nonstop, you know, what you would expect from the people involved. We had Los Ingobernales, Sanada, Evil, Bushi, and Hiromu Takahashi against Jushin Thunder Liger, Volador Jr., Dragon Lee, and Titan. Takahashi pinned Titan after Evil hit him with a chair. I didn't really care for the match, but it's always cool to see Jushin Thunder Liger. I'm still kind of disappointed that WWE only brought him in for the one match against Tyler Breeze. I thought they'd bring him in for specials here and there. We haven't seen him back since. But he's still very entertaining to watch. So very cool to see Liger. We had a series of U.S. title tournament matches. Again, part of what they're looking to accomplish this weekend is to crown a brand new, first time ever, New Japan, or I guess IWGP, United States Champion. You saw the new belt. It's got the red strap, like the Universal title. Not a big fan of that. So they're crowning a new champion. They have a tournament that's ongoing. We had a bunch of tournament matches here tonight. We had Jay Lethal. The aforementioned Jay Lethal beating Hangman Page with the Lethal Injection to advance. We had Juice Robinson and Zack Sabre Jr. Juice Robinson, for those who don't know, is the former CJ Parker, who I used to rag on in NXT. And to watch him now and remember where he was when he was doing that gimmick in NXT, it's like night and day. This guy's really good. You could see how good he's gotten working over there in Japan. I thought up to this point, this was the best match on the show. We know how good Zack Sabre Jr. is, and they work well together. Zack got the win with a submission. I forgot the name of it, but he won with a submission hold in the end here to advance. But I just wanted to make that comment about Juice Robinson that I've seen some of his work, you know, in Japan since leaving WWE and NXT. But this was probably the best match I've ever seen him have. And I don't know. I think I Did he work against Naito for the Intercontinental? I don't know if it was Naito or Tanahashi. He may have had a better match than this, but this was the best I've seen of him. And I was very impressed. We had Tanahashi, the legendary Hiroshi Tanahashi, who is the reigning Intercontinental Champion, teaming with Kushida, Jay White, and Dave Finley against Billy Gunn. Yes, Billy Gunn. And Yoshitatsu. As well as Komatsu and Tanaka. Yeah, they like their eight-man tags here in New Japan. The good thing about Yoshitatsu being in this match is that it meant he was not able to do commentary. Thank God. What little we had to see here of Tanahashi in there with Billy Gunn, because Tanahashi and Billy Gunn are having a match tonight, night two, which won't air until Friday. And I hope I have a chance to see this, because I'm very curious to see what kind of match these two have. But if this was any indication, I don't have very high hopes for this Intercontinental Championship match that Tanahashi is going to have with Billy Gunn tonight. Billy was... he looked good. He towered over everybody in that ring. He's a big dude. I can vouch for that because I did the interview with him at WrestleCon. He's a big dude. And he's in great shape, but he was a few steps behind. He was in there with Tanahashi. There were some things that were mistimed. It looked a little wonky. But he's also 53 years old. So you think to yourself, it's understandable. You know, he's 53. Then again, I remind myself that only a few matches before this, we saw Jushin Thunder Liger on this show, and he's 52. He's only a year younger than Billy Gunn, and he didn't look like he's missed a beat. So, make of that what you will. But in the end, Jay White pinned Yoshi with the flatliner. They had an intermission, which kind of brought me back to the days when they had intermissions during WrestleMania. I remember that. I remember watching. I'd be sitting in front of the TV. They'd have the five-minute countdown. It was always a five-minute intermission. And you'd hear all the ambient noise in the background from the crowd and whatnot. And I would just watch the countdown tick away, second by second, just waiting for WrestleMania to come back on the air. Now it feels like I can't wait for WrestleMania to end sometimes. The shows are so long. So when the intermission was over, we had War Machine against the Gorillas of Destiny. And War Machine won the IWGP Tag Team titles. We had a title change here. They hit their finish on Camacho through a table. I still call him Camacho. I can't help it. When I see him, that's what I think. Well, I think two things. I think Camacho, and I think the son of Haku, obviously. So he comes from a very tough background. And also, much improved here, I have to say, from the last time I saw him in WWE, just like Juice Robinson, much improved. Tomohiro Ishii pinned Tetsuya Naito in a U.S. title tournament match to advance. That was surprising. I did not see that result coming. Probably the biggest upset of the night, I would say. He won with a brain buster. They had a great match, hard-hitting match. Of course, it's an Ishii match, so what do you expect? Second best match. I thought this was the second best match on the show besides the next match, which was Kenny Omega against Michael Elgin in yet another U.S. tournament match. These guys killed it. Well, they killed each other, but these guys killed it. Killed it. How do you like that? The two Canadians stole the show on Canada Day. Omega ate a German suplex at one point on the apron. He got folded up. I thought he was dead. Last few minutes of this match were insane. Omega has the best looking, best sounding knee strikes of anybody in all of wrestling right now. My one criticism of it, though, my one criticism of the match... he throws too many of them. I lost track. It had to have been every bit of 8 or 9 knee strikes that he threw. And again, as good as they are and as good as they sound and they look, he shouldn't have to throw more than 1 or 2 or 3 at the most. You know what I mean? But when you get to like number 8, 9, and 10, it starts to lose its effect. So I thought there was too much of that. Same thing for the matches he had with Okada. Honestly, as great as those matches were, just too many of them. You know, too many of those, too many kickouts. You know, I don't know what the magic number is. I don't think you don't nail down a specific number. You just sort of feel it. But I feel like you get to that point in the match where there's that one near fall too many. You know what I mean? I'm sure everybody has seen this before, whether it's in New Japan or it's in Ring of Honor or even WWE. They hit that one near fall. It's like, they went too far. That said, still... best match on the entire show, I thought. Omega hit the one-winged angel and got the pin. Excellent match. Kenny Omega is a beast. I mean, he's been just having an unbelievable year. So is Okada. I think Okada might be, you know, Okada might be on such a roll right now. I don't know that anybody in the history of wrestling has had this kind of run that he's on right now of just classic match after classic match, one right after the other after the other. Omega's not too far behind. Kenny Omega's giving him a run for his money here. He has just turned into a completely different performer. And it's going to be a very interesting 2018 for him, because does he stay with New Japan? Does he leave? And if he leaves, I think you all know where he's going, because I don't think he would leave if not just for one other place. And that's his decision to make. I don't see him staying with New Japan, so read into that what you will. But it's going to be very interesting to see where he ends up, and whoever gets him is going to be better off for it. I just hope they allow him, and you could say this about any star like him, that they allow him and give him enough freedom and enough leeway to, you know, to do what has gotten him over up to this point. But we'll see. We'll follow that story heading into the new year. But I have to say this too, you know, Michael Elgin, it's very easy to talk about Omega, but Elgin deserves every bit as much credit here as Omega does, because Elgin is on a tear of his own, and Elgin is incredible. And I thought he was awesome. He was excellent here in this match. And both guys deserve a lot of credit for putting on, you know, that show that they did last night. It was something else. Okada and Cody was the main event for the IWGP Heavyweight title. This is fresh off Cody's Ring of Honor title win. I thought they had a good match. I thought that this probably was the... If I had to, like, rank them, and it's so hard to rank them because, again, Okada's had so many incredible matches recently. This is probably at the bottom of the list. This is probably the weakest of the Okada matches, but even the weakest Okada match is still very good. And Cody held his own. It got a little choppy there at the end, but as the match approached its conclusion, Kenny Omega comes walking out. He's got a white towel in his hand. And this was a takeoff, essentially, of what we saw on the last show when Omega and Okada went to that 60-minute draw. And Omega just looked like he was near death in that match. And Cody came out. Both guys, of course, are members of Bullet Club. They're supposed to be on the same side. They're supposed to be allies. And Cody came out with a white towel, and he was about to throw it in for Omega and cost him the match. Good thing he didn't, because Omega fought his way back. But clearly they were planting the seeds of dissension in the ranks of Bullet Club, setting something up for the future between Omega and Cody, and some sort of split. And so here comes Kenny Omega doing the exact same thing that Cody almost did to him in the Okada match, threatening to throw in the white towel. Cody's wife Brandy was out there. She had been in the crowd, but at some point she leapt over the barricade, and now she was at ringside. And Omega tried to give her the towel and said, "You throw it in. It should be you. Look at him. He's dying out there. You got to throw in the towel." And Cody, of course, did what Omega did. He fought back. He came back into it. So again, good thing they didn't throw the towel in. Now, I could be wrong about this. I don't remember the announcers bringing that up at all, that this was essentially the same exact thing that Cody had done to Omega at that Dominion show. Again, maybe they did. Maybe there was a mention of it, but I don't remember there being one. And if not, that's a huge thing for the announcers to neglect. Because that's an important point. That was kind of the whole point of this, is to draw that distinction and show that, hey, you know, tit for tat here. Omega's doing what Cody did to him. And offhand, I just don't remember the announcers even making a mention of that, which is really bad if they didn't. So Cody ducked a Rainmaker. He hit his own Rainmaker. Okada kicked out. People were going crazy for this thing. Okada actually hit a crossroads on Cody. He used Cody's own move on him. Cody went for a one-winged angel, a nice little nod there to Omega, or an FU to Omega, depending on how you look at it. Okada slipped out of it. This was the point where Cody was mistiming some stuff. There was a couple of things that were sort of botched. Okada recovered. He saved it by turning it into a tombstone. And in the end, he hit a Rainmaker, and he retained the IWGP Championship. Again, this was a pretty good match. The best Cody Rhodes singles match that I've ever seen. And I say singles because the best Cody Rhodes match I've ever seen is still the Rhodes Brothers against the Shield at that Battleground pay-per-view with Dusty in their corner. That is still, in my opinion, the best Cody Rhodes match. Omega took the mic after the match was over. It was Omega and Okada in the ring. He admitted that he was jealous of Okada getting to headline the show, but they have a rematch coming up in the G1 Climax next month, and he said, tonight is your night. He said, tonight is Okada's night. He handed him the mic, and off went Kenny Omega. And there is dissension in the ranks of Bullet Club backstage. They were going at it verbally. They were verbally sparring, and the Young Bucks were trying to hold Cody away from Omega and hold Omega away from Cody, and I think Cody flipped over a table out of anger. So this is definitely building to something. I would assume Cody is either going to cost Omega the U.S. title tonight at night two at the tapings, or if not, that he will cost Omega his match against Okada next month in the G1. But either way, I think that there is a split coming, and then we'll see. I mean, do they do Cody and Omega at Wrestle Kingdom next year and put Okada in there with somebody else? I don't know. Would seem to make sense. And again, if they have any sense that Omega may not be sticking around, then I don't know why they would put Omega in there against Okada and or give him the championship if they think he's going to leave. So it could very well be that at Wrestle Kingdom next year, if they can hold off that long, we could be headed for a Cody-Omega singles match. But I thought as a first effort with a major U.S. show like this, I thought it was good. I would go as high as probably a 7 out of 10. Because there's definitely room for improvement. This was not the best New Japan show that I've ever seen. But when you have two matches like the Naito match, the Naito and the Omega match, you can't. I don't feel like you can give a show less than that. It's not like the other matches were bad either. But when you have two matches like that and a good main event, I can't go lower than 7 out of 10. I might even go 7.5, but that's as high as I would go. The commentary, I thought the commentary actually brought it down a little bit, and I never thought I would say that about a show called by Jim Ross. But this was not his best night. I will say that. Now, night two in Long Beach is taping tonight. Like I said, it does not air on Access TV until this Friday, and that will include the most anticipated Intercontinental title defense of Tanahashi defending against Billy Gunn. I guess they just feel like for their first foray into the U.S. market, they had to not load the show, but they had to add to the show some familiar faces that were stars that, you know, mainstream fans or casual fans would recognize. So we saw people like Billy Gunn on the show. And, you know, does it make a difference? Probably not. And he definitely looked out of place. To say he stuck out like a sore thumb is an understatement. But I get why they're doing that. But I am very curious to see how that unfolds when you have someone like Billy Gunn, who, it's one thing to go in there and do a move here and there and do a tilt-a-whirl backbreaker and it looks really impressive. But when you're in there one-on-one as opposed to an eight-man tag situation, it's a very different situation. And when I say I'm looking forward to that match, it's not because I'm expecting a classic, put it that way. I want to talk about GLOW. And I'm not trying to avoid talking about Raw and SmackDown and all that, although most weeks I would be. I'm going to get to that in a second, but a lot of you have said to me, you got to watch GLOW, the new Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling show on Netflix, which is a takeoff off the GLOW show, the GLOW promotion back in the 80s, which was relatively short-lived. But that's sort of what this is based off of. But it's a drama. I mean, it's sort of like a, I guess they would call it like a dramedy, a mix of drama and comedy. It kind of reminds me of a show like Orange is the New Black, which I watched the first two seasons of that show and then I sort of fell out of it. But it was a good show. And so I knew that there were some wrestler cameos in this and you guys were recommending it to me. And so I wanted to watch it. I'm almost done with it. I've had 3 episodes left to go. So I have not finished it yet. But I'm almost there. There's 10 episodes total that all dropped at once from season 1. I assume there may be more seasons if the show did well enough, but right now it's just 1 season. And I really enjoy the show. I think it's a hell of a show. I think it's really, really good, and it's absolutely worth going out of your way to check it out. It's half an hour each episode. There are some episodes where I'm waiting for another half an hour. I kind of wish it was 60 minutes, but each episode is half an hour, and a few things that struck me. So just to give you the basic premise, there is one main character that the show is based around. Her name on the show is Ruth. She's an actress, and she's looking for gigs, and she ends up with this gig, which is they're filming a pilot for a professional wrestling television show. And the person directing it is this famous director. I don't want to say he's had a fall from grace, but this is sort of his new project, and he's not a wrestling fan. He doesn't know the first thing about wrestling, but he's the one directing it. And Marc Maron, you may be familiar with that name. Marc Maron has one of the most popular podcasts out there. He's interviewed the president in his garage, for God's sake. And that's how I became familiar. I knew he was a comedian and all that, but I've never really seen Marc Maron act before. And I was struck by how good he was here on this show. I was very impressed by his performance here on this show. As far as cameos by other wrestlers and people that you may know, there are a bunch of familiar faces on the show. And again, if you don't want to know about any of this stuff, I'm not really going into plot lines. I'm just giving some basic thoughts. But if you don't want to know, if you're that sensitive, you can skip ahead. But Alex Riley, my old friend, Alex Riley, does make an appearance as the the Steel Horse, I believe, here on this show. I will say they covered up his terrible back tattoo. He's posing on the ring ropes at one point, and I noticed. I said, "Oh, there's no tattoo." So they covered up that horrible thing. So he's on the show. He's in one episode, unless he's in one of the later episodes I haven't gotten to yet. He appears on one episode. There's also cameos from Tyrus and Carlito, who I believe are brothers. Their father is a famous pro wrestler, and their sister is training. She's one of the characters on the show who's training to become a pro wrestler, so she comes from a wrestling family. I think they're her brothers. Maybe they're cousins, but I think they're her brothers. But Tyrus plays one, Carlito plays the other. Carlito, he doesn't have the giant afro. He, like, wetted his hair down. But one of the funniest things I popped for was there's one episode where they're training some of the other ladies. They're going to give them a training session in their ring in the backyard. And Carlito comes out of the house and he's got an apple. And I popped. I just thought, that's pretty cool. John Morrison, Johnny Mundo, makes a very brief appearance. I think it was only in the first episode, I think. Maybe the first one or two. As a wrestler who they bring in to sort of be a trainer on the show, but then eventually the director just lets him go. So he briefly makes an appearance. Christopher Daniels makes an appearance in one scene in a match. I didn't even know he was on the show. They credit Chavo Guerrero Jr. in the credits. I know he was one of the trainers, I think. I think he helped train the ladies. I don't know if he ever makes an appearance on one of these episodes. I haven't seen him yet. It was very nice of them, though, at the end of one of the episodes, they did a sort of an in-memory tribute to his father, so they must have just wrapped on that show around the time his father passed away, Chavo Classic. But I really have been... I've been enjoying the show also because it doesn't... It's so easy, and we've seen this before in movies and other forms of entertainment, where it's almost like they kind of talk down on wrestling, or they don't portray wrestling in the greatest light. I think that their portrayal of wrestling here is fairly accurate, and they don't go out of their way to make wrestling fans seem dumb and to make wrestling seem dumb. I actually think they do a pretty good job of respecting the business, the art, whatever you want to call it, and staying true to what it is. You know, people are dropping terms like heel and babyface and stuff like that. So you're going to have a lot of casual fans or non-wrestling fans who aren't familiar with the lingo, who are going to all of a sudden pick up on wrestling lingo and stuff like that. You could actually get an education, I think, watching this show. But I don't think they treat it with any sort of disrespect. And because I didn't know what to expect when I was going to watch this. It'd be very easy to make wrestling into a joke. Because it is, I mean, right? It's not that it's a joke, but it's kind of a circus-like atmosphere. Like, there's no other form of entertainment like professional wrestling. You can't really... It's hard to explain what the wrestling business really is to someone. I think even if you're in the wrestling business, it would be hard to explain to a non-fan exactly what wrestling is and have them get it. I feel like you either get it or you don't. If you keep an open mind, that's great. A lot of people don't have an open mind. They look at wrestling and they think it's this lowbrow form of entertainment and all wrestling fans have one tooth and they drag their knuckles on the floor. And I thought that they were fairly respectful, and it helped probably having people like Chavo and others that they brought in to help train and probably give some guidance behind the scenes about what it's really like. So if you are a Netflix subscriber, I would definitely check out Glow. If you're not a Netflix subscriber, I would subscribe just to watch Glow, because I think it's a really good show. And if I change my mind after watching the final three episodes, I'll let you know. The main storyline, though, without giving too much away, though, is, again, I mentioned that character Ruth, the actress who ends up on this show. She basically sleeps with her best friend's husband. And her best friend, who's also an actress, ends up on the show. And so they have to work together. And so you have the underlying drama of that. Again, it's not all about wrestling. I wouldn't call it a wrestling show. It's a show that's sort of wrapped in professional wrestling. But on its own, I think it's just a very well-acted, entertaining 30 minutes per episode to watch. So I give it a thumbs up. Okay, let's do a deep dive here into Monday Night Raw from this past week. Live from Los Angeles, 2,500 votes in our Twitter poll, 56% thumbs up, 44% thumbs down. The first time that Raw has earned an overall positive score in many weeks. So that's a plus. And this week was a perfect example of how bipolar this show can be. Now, last week, on this three-hour-plus show, the women got 90 seconds of airtime. I mean, they couldn't care. They could not have possibly cared less. They put them out there. They rushed them right out. This week, they get over half an hour in the main event. And it was a damn good main event. We also had Samoa Joe nearly choking out Brock Lesnar in one of the highlights of the show. Big Cass turn heel again on Enzo Amore because Enzo is dumb. Braun Strowman killed Roman Reigns, which is always fun to watch. And Miz TV. Miz TV gave us one of the more horrendous celebrity appearances on Raw, and there have been a good number of them. But this was a bad one. First, though, there's some potentially big news I want to get into, and that is that there is a rumored change in the card for SummerSlam, and it is big, if true. This is according to the latest Wrestling Observer. Vince McMahon has apparently decided to bump up his planned WrestleMania main event for next year to SummerSlam this year, with Brock Lesnar defending the Universal Championship against Roman Reigns. Now, I know a lot of you are going to groan when you hear that. I don't want to see that match. Fuck Roman. And all this other stuff. Now, if you remember, though, a few weeks ago, I said that I would be fine. I was almost advocating for them. As much as I want to see that Strowman-Lesnar match, I was almost advocating for them to move that match up to SummerSlam instead of dragging it out until next year, because all you're doing is delaying the inevitable for a match that a lot of people are just going to groan when they hear, you know, oh, it's going to be Roman against Brock at WrestleMania. And, you know, it's like we could see it coming from a mile away. And everything feels like it's in a holding pattern until then. Brock barely appears anyway. But we all know that all roads lead to this moment at WrestleMania. Just get it over with. Just get it over with at SummerSlam. Why wait? Because I guess the rumor now is that they'll do the match at SummerSlam and at WrestleMania next year. And this may also not sit well with people, but the rumor is that it may be Roman Reigns, whether it's for the championship or not, I don't know, against John Cena in the main event of WrestleMania next year. My take is this. If they want to do it next month, the Roman-Brock match, be my guest. I will also say this. Reigns and Lesnar have one singles match on record. They've been in, I think, maybe one or two like triple threats. But they've only had one singles match. And that was a WrestleMania 31. And in case you forgot, they had an excellent match at WrestleMania 31. So as a match, it's very unlikely that they're going to go in there and have a bad match. But here's the little wrinkle in all this. And this could also blow up plans if Vince changes his mind again. If things are going so well, he wants to make a change. And I kind of hope he does. Because I'm watching this Samoa Joe Brock Lesnar stuff play out in real time, as we all are. And it's impossible. It is impossible for this to be a one-and-done scenario. This cannot end at great balls of fire between these two guys. They have to go at least one more match, that being at SummerSlam. And I said before, I hate that it bumps the Strowman-Lesnar match. I've been calling for that match since January. I do think at some point, whether it's SummerSlam this year or WrestleMania next year or Royal Rumble or whenever it may be, we are going to get Brock Lesnar and Braun Strowman at some point. But Samoa Joe has been knocking it out of the park every single week. He has taken this thing and he has ran with it. He deserves better than just being a speed bump for Brock heading into SummerSlam. And so I think they need to do one of two things next Sunday. They either need to do a disputed finish or a non-finish in the main event, which I know is going to piss some people off. But you do that, and that leads to a rematch at SummerSlam with a stip, maybe no holds barred or something like that. Or you put the title on Joe next Sunday. You improvise things here, all your plans, and you put the championship on Samoa Joe. Brock would then get his rematch, so they could do the match again. But wouldn't that get people talking? If Samoa Joe goes in there and he beats Brock Lesnar for the Universal Championship. Now, there is another idea, and I floated this before. The idea of doing a Fatal 4-Way at SummerSlam with Brock, Joe, Roman, and Strowman for the championship. Joe and Lesnar go to a non-finish of Great Balls of Fire. The other two get added to the mix. And I would make it an elimination match with Joe going over and getting the title if he doesn't get it next Sunday. I'd be okay with that scenario too. You've got a few different options here. But I think the key is that you have in Samoa Joe a rare thing on this television show. Brock Lesnar fits the same mold. And I think that's why this works so well. You're taking two guys that are alike in these ways. In that Brock and Joe, why does this work so well? Ask yourself that question. Why does this seem to be firing on all cylinders when a lot of other stuff on the show isn't? It's because you've got two guys here who are real. They look real. They feel real. You can go out there and believe that these guys are going to beat your ass. Brock Lesnar fits the exact same mold, but we only get to see him a few times each year. With Joe, you have a full-time guy who comes off as a believable, legitimate badass. The way he walks, the way he talks, just the way he carries himself. There are very few other people like that. Too few, unfortunately, on that roster. I mean, back in the day, look, I hate to keep going back to the Attitude Era, but I always think back, you know, Austin was Austin, right? There's only one Steve Austin. Austin had the BMF walk when he would come out. Austin just looked like a badass. He looked like he was coming down to beat someone's ass. But there were a lot of guys who had that attitude about them at the time. It wasn't just Austin. You had Rock had an attitude like that. Undertaker had an attitude like that. You could even say Triple H. You know, heel Triple H had an attitude like that. You know, Kane. Kane was a freaking monster. That guy was a destroyer back then. And you had a lot of guys. You had 3, 4, 5 different guys like that. Now you got Brock, you got Joe, and who else is like that? Who else is like that on either roster right now? Strowman. I'll say Strowman. Braun Strowman, they've done a tremendous job with Braun Strowman. I would throw him on that list too. But again, you look at all the guys on Raw and SmackDown, and not everybody is going to be a badass. You got your comedy characters, you got your chicken shit heels. It's good to have a mix of different people, but they don't have enough of these guys. They don't have enough of these guys that the fans, when they're on TV, they pay attention. They stop what they're doing. Raw no longer becomes background noise, and they focus on what's happening on screen. And so with the Joe and Lesnar stuff, you know, the interest is there. I guess we'll know if they get a ton of new subscribers for the network heading into next Sunday. That'll be another way to measure interest in this feud. But they can't squander that. Don't squander that. They got to jump all over it. Don't botch it up. Don't have him lose right now. Make, you know, just him losing clean and moving on would be the mother of all botches. The end result here, I think, is Universal Champion Samoa Joe, whether it's next Sunday or next month in Brooklyn. You can make money with this guy. They've got a good thing going right now. Don't screw it up. As I am recording this, I see a tweet here from our president of the United States, Mr. Trump, who tweeted out Hashtag fraud news CNN. And a 30-second clip here from WrestleMania 23, the Battle of the Billionaires. And in this clip, you see Steve Austin. This is the president's Twitter account. And there's Stone Cold Steve Austin in his referee shirt, laid down on the mat. Vince McMahon is outside the ring leaning over him, I guess trash-talking him. There's a giant CNN block logo over Vince's head. And then in comes Trump, tackling Vince to the ground. I guess, you know, he starts pounding on him. He's beating the hell out of CNN. He just tweeted this out. Let me see here. About an hour ago, it looks like. I just saw it. I never thought I would live to see the day where a president of the United States is tweeting out clips from WrestleMania. Yeah. It's just, is this real life? Like, I don't even know anymore. I just don't even know. Oh my. You know what? I have to say, I know Linda McMahon is the head of, she's the Small Business Administration head, whatever her title is. I'm kind of shocked that Vince doesn't have a position in the cabinet already. I feel like he'd fit right in there. And he would probably give Vince whatever he wants. Vince could be the new Minister of Defense, create a new position for him or something. What position would Vince McMahon fill in a Trump administration? That's a good question. I'll let you guys answer that. What position do you think Vince McMahon would be best equipped? Head of creative. He can head creative for the country. Then we'd be in some real trouble. Can you imagine Vince McMahon running creative for the US of A? What would things look like with Vince McMahon in that position? I shudder to think. Anyway, back to our regularly scheduled programming here. Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar walked out. This was one of the highlights of the show right here. He walked out. He was doing his whole entrance. He was bouncing up and down. And Samoa Joe came up from behind. He attacked him before Brock could even take a step down the ramp. Nobody has ever done that to Lesnar before. So that was cool to see. Joe put him in the coquina clutch. Lesnar struggled. He tried unsuccessfully to fight his way out of it. His face started to turn purple. Joe would not let go. So out comes the revival. Out comes the club. They're trying to pry Joe off of him. Finally, they do. Fans are chanting, let them fight. This is the most anticipated match in this company in a very long time. And I have to say, it's been very refreshing to see how they've pushed Joe here so early in his time on the main roster. He's only been there really since, what, the beginning of February, probably? And in a lot of ways, his push reminds me of the push that AJ Styles got. Now, when AJ initially came in, he debuted in the Rumble, he had a feud with Chris Jericho, he lost to Jericho at WrestleMania, but then all of a sudden he had back-to-back championship matches with Roman Reigns, he was feuding with John Cena, he was beating John Cena, then he won the championship at Backlash from Dean Ambrose. Like, all of these, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger for AJ, and he became arguably the biggest star, well, maybe not the biggest star, but one of the best performers in the entire company, and certainly one of the biggest stars in the entire company. And Joe came in, he was the hired assassin of Triple H, right? He had the feud with Seth Rollins, and Seth got hurt, wasn't on TV a whole lot, it kind of stalled things for a while. But I thought, and I've made the comment here on the podcast before everybody started talking this week about, oh my goodness, look at how great WWE's booking Samoa Joe. Go back to March. You can find the clip online. I was talking about how pleasantly surprised I was. And some people thought I was nuts. They're like, are you out of your mind? They have him in a mid-card feud with Seth Rollins. I'm like, you know what? He's the hired assassin of the COO of the company against Seth Rollins, one of the top baby faces on the brand. I don't see what's so bad about that. They could have brought Samoa Joe in there with a face tattoo, doing dances like the modern-day Rikishi. I would not put that past these people. But they came in, and I think from the beginning, for the most part, they've done right by him. Look, on his first night, he pinned Roman Reigns. Who cares if Braun Strowman interfered or someone interfered? Who gives a shit? They position him in a pretty good way ever since the moment he came up. And it's refreshing to see. I didn't expect AJ Styles to get anything, any sort of semblance of the kind of push he ended up getting. I was amazed. I continue to be amazed that they pushed AJ as hard and as quickly as they did just a few months into his run. Coming straight over, TNA original, right? I mean, he had been gone. He went to Ring of Honor. He went to New Japan. But he still, you know, he was a TNA guy. He was a TNA original. And right out of the gate, they pushed him hard. I mean, how could they not, right? Styles is so good. Well, so is Joe. And it's nice to see that they see the value. Because we know Triple H saw the value. That's why he brought him into NXT. But it doesn't matter so much what Triple H thinks once you make it to the main roster. It's all about one guy. And it's nice to see that that one guy sees the value in having someone like Joe on that roster. Roman Reigns was interrupted by an ambulance during his opening promo, being backed into the arena. He went over to investigate, and he got jumped by Braun Strowman, who ended up tossing him from the stage into the side of the ambulance and crashing down to the floor. And Braun then threw him into the back of the ambulance, sent the ambulance off, and that was the last we saw of the big dog for the rest of the show. I thought it was simple, to the point, puts over the ambulance stipulation at the pay-per-view, keeps Braun Strowman looking like a monster. So I thought this succeeded on all levels here. He and Roman always work well together. I expect them to have a great match next Sunday. You can give Roman all the grief you want, but the one thing is the dude delivers in big matches. I don't care how much smack people want to talk about him, and I have my own issues with him, but he always delivers in big matches, as John Cena does, frankly, in most of his big pay-per-view matches. And you can argue, well, it's the person he's working with. I mean, Roman's worked with a nice mix of people. He's worked with Brock, who unfortunately doesn't do as much as he used to. Brock is Brock, right? We know what Brock brings to the table. You know, and yeah, Roman will work with somebody like an AJ Styles, and we know how good AJ is, but we've seen Roman now work with Strowman a whole bunch of times, and Strowman has gotten good. But it's not like Strowman's in there being Ric Flair. You know what I mean? Strowman, you know, especially at the beginning there, he needed a lot of help. And I thought Roman was a good dance partner for him. Roman's had a lot of good matches. I expect more of the same next weekend. They had a match where the Hardys teamed up for the first time with Finn Balor against the Drifter, Sheamus, and Cesaro. It was a nice little novelty thing, I thought, seeing Balor teaming up with Matt and Jeff. I think Jeff Hardy against the Demon Balor, with all their face paint and everything else, I think that could be a big pay-per-view match at some point. All the women in the audience, I think if that match ever happened, all their ovaries would just explode. So my recommendation would be to bring a poncho if you have a ticket to that show. Balor pins Cesaro with the coup de grace. They had Josh Duhamel from the new Transformers movie on commentary. I don't really give a shit about that. I didn't really give a shit about what he had to say. Other than I recognized him from a movie I saw many years ago called Turistas that I remember liking. It's been a while since I've seen it, but at the time I remember liking it. So I won't rag on the guy too much. I actually enjoyed that movie. So after weeks and weeks of buildup, we finally got the long-anticipated battle between Goldust and R-Truth. Goldust came out wearing the same outfit he wore when he first debuted back in 1995. Only no wig. Goldust used to have an usher, if you remember. There was a stretch where he would have an usher deliver golden telegrams to his opponents. Now he has his own cameraman decked out in gold. We'll see how long this gimmick lasts for. I give it 2 weeks before they drop the cameraman. The match never got started because Goldust beat up Truth before the bell, slammed his head into the ring post. This was perhaps the lamest beatdown that I've ever seen. But at least now we know we have our kickoff match for the pay-per-view next weekend. They haven't announced it yet, but let's be honest here. This is going to be the kickoff match. By the way, think of the promos we would get from that Goldust character if there was a pay-per-view called Great Balls of Fire back in 1995 or 1996. Think of the early incarnation of that Goldust character feeling up Razor Ramon and all the homoerotic undertones and the feud with Piper and Warrior. Warrior went off on him once on the show. There's a promo that wouldn't go over very well today. if the Ultimate Warrior cut the same promo on Goldust today that he did back then, I think Raw would be off the air. But imagine that. Imagine a Great Balls of Fire pay-per-view with that Goldust character back in the day. You won't get to see that now, I promise you that. You won't get to see those promos today. Speaking of balls, that brings us to Miz TV with the Ball family as his guests. This was quite the polarizing segment based on the online reaction. And also the mainstream reaction in terms of they were hoping to get a lot of publicity out of this, and they did, but a lot of it was for the wrong reasons. So this thing was polarizing in every possible way. They promoted LeVar Ball as being on Raw. Now, I have no idea. At the time, I had no idea who LeVar Ball even was, nor did I care. His big claim to fame is that he is the father of the number two draft pick in the NBA draft. The kid, they say, who will lead the Los Angeles Lakers to greatness. Good, when he's done, maybe he can help the Mets out. He ran down to the ring, LeVar Ball did, like he had a piece of hot coal shoved up his ass. He came out with his other son, LaMelo, apparently is 15 years old with a Sideshow Bob haircut. LeVar introduced his other son, Lonzo. He's the draft pick that I just mentioned. So we had the two sons in the ring with the dad. The rest of this was a complete train wreck. They teased a fight between LeVar and The Miz. Miz took his shirt off, then LeVar took his shirt off. He started doing karate poses. They quickly sent out Dean Ambrose to put an end to this. And as Ambrose was coming out, LaMelo, the 15-year-old, used the slang version of the N-word twice in the course of telling his father to beat Miz's ass. Suddenly, this became Ballgate. WWE was forced to put out a statement saying the inappropriate language used by a guest during the Miz TV segment was not scripted nor reflects WWE's values. See, this is what happens when you put a 15-year-old kid on live TV. When you put a live mic in a kid's hand, guess what? There's pretty good chance that something bad is going to happen. So WWE has only themselves to blame for what happened here. To me, this is not a big story. If it hasn't already been forgotten, by the time Raw goes on the air tomorrow night, this will be a distant memory. It was a stupid thing to say on television. It's one thing to say it with friends, to say it in private, to say it at school, to say it wherever. You're on live TV, you should know better than to say it. It was stupid, but you know what? They had no business being on the show in the first place. They wanted to, WWE, they love trending on Twitter. And by the way, it'll probably annoy them to no end that G1 in the USA was the number one trend last night on Twitter. But they wanted to trend on Twitter. They wanted to get themselves a SportsCenter moment. Which is funny. I was on the phone with a guy who used to write for WWE, an ex-writer, while this segment was on. And he said to me, he goes, you know, who are these people and why are they on TV? And I said, well, you know, I explained to him what I knew of them. And I said, they want their SportsCenter moment. That's what WWE wants. And his response was, who watches SportsCenter anymore? And I thought about that and I had no response. I didn't know how to respond to that because he's not wrong, right? He's not wrong in making that statement. The funny thing is, they probably ended up getting as much negative publicity for what the kids said than getting anything positive out of this. But this still wasn't as bad as the This Is Your Life atrocity from a few months ago. This was far from the worst thing I've ever seen on Raw. This didn't make me angry or anything. It was just stupid. It was a stupid waste of time. And I will say this also. I legitimately did not know who LeVar Ball was when they first announced this. I had to look him up online. And I did not realize that his wife had a stroke earlier this year. A pretty bad one from what I understand. I think to the point that she's still in the hospital. And I think she's no longer able to speak. And there were some stories about what happened and its effect on the family. And I read that he's been by her side ever since. Which he should be, I mean, given that it's his wife, but, you know, that's what a real man does. He stands by his wife, he supports her. But I'm sure that's been very hard on him and his family. I mean, maybe it's just because of the stuff I'm going through with my own mother right now, but I have a lot of sympathy for what those guys must be going through. And, look, it's obvious the guy loves his kids. He's over the top, he's out of his mind, but he obviously loves his kids, so, you know, how can you not respect that? But I do have one criticism when it comes to that. In doing all the reading up on this guy, I saw that after his kid got drafted to the Lakers a few weeks ago, he made a promise. Not only did he make a promise, he made a very public guarantee that Lonzo will lead the Lakers to the playoffs in his first year with the team. This kid's been in the league barely 5 minutes, and his father is already out there making guarantees. I get being confident in your kid and all, that's great, but don't do that. Don't put that kind of pressure on the kid. Like, if I'm a Lakers fan, that's what I'm thinking. I'm like, don't jinx this. What are you doing? Let the kid do his thing. He doesn't need you out there making guarantees for him. Enzo Amore came out for a promo. Enzo's done a pretty incredible job with his promo work, I think, since this whole cast turn took place, from the tears streaming down the face to his promo work on Monday. I'll give him credit for that, but boy, does he come off like a total goober in this whole thing. He came out after this guy turned on him. So Cass admitted that, you know, he knocked Enzo out probably multiple times. And then he boots the guy in the face. He says all those horrible things about him on television. So what does Enzo do? Enzo comes back out the next week, and it's like, there's a word for it. Was it like, I don't know if Stockholm syndrome is not the right word for it, but there's like, it reminds me of when Dick Cheney shot his friend in the face, and the friend had to apologize. It's like, I'm sorry I was in the way and that you shot me in the face. Like, it's that sort of thing. Like, this guy is out there. He should be ready to beat Cass. He should be out there with, like, the biggest lead pipe in the world, waiting for Cass to walk through that back door and just waffle the fuck out of him with that thing. But he's out there in the ring, and he's like, look, I know you didn't mean to do what you did, so let's just forget all this stuff ever happened, and let's just be best friends again. So, of course, Cass came out looking all sullen and downtrodden, and he apologized, and you could see this coming from a mile away. I will say, as predictable as this was, they did a good job with it, because they milked this thing. They had Cass apologize, they had them embrace, they had them hold hands in the middle of the ring, raise his arm up, and you're waiting for him to just lower the boom, and he never did. And they left the ring together, and they went up the ramp. Now it kind of reminds me of Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, when Kevin Owens turned on Sami on that TakeOver show where, you know, they're starting to walk up the ramp, and then Owens, you know, clobbers him. But they got to the top of the ramp, and then at that point, Cass finally, you know, he clotheslined Enzo, knocked him down. You know what it also reminds me of? Remember the Savage Crush Summit from Raw back in 93? How they were supposedly best of friends, and Crush resented Savage for not helping him when Yokozuna injured him and not calling him when he was convalescing and all that stuff. And they had this summit, this debate in the ring, because Crush was going to go with Mr. Fuji. And Savage tried to talk him out of it, and then in the end, they embraced and they left the ring. Everything looked like it was all hunky-dory until they left the ring and they're about to walk out together, and then Crush clotheslined him, and then he dropped him throat first on the barrier. It was that sort of thing. I thought they did a pretty good job with it. I thought both guys played their role really well here, especially Enzo, even though he comes off looking like a moron. So the double turn here. This is the second heel turn that Cass has now done to poor Enzo Amore. We had Seth Rollins beating Curt Hawkins, and then he was interrupted by the eater of pins and planches, Bray Wyatt, with another giant heaping of word salad up on the Titantron. I don't even pay attention to what he says anymore. It's just a bunch of words. Word salad. That's all it is. I don't think I can adequately convey to all of you in words how little I care about this feud, how little interest I have in seeing this match. Maybe if like JoJo jumps in the ring during the match and gives Rollins a low blow and helps Bray win at the pay-per-view, and they put Bray and JoJo together as like a new thing, like they put Edge and Lita together, then I might actually be interested in this. They don't have the balls to do that, though. Main event was a gauntlet match where each woman drew a random number from a tumbler backstage over the course of the show to determine who entered the match when. So Nia Jax and Bayley opened the match. It only took Nia 3 minutes to finish off Bayley with a Samoan drop. So I am not so much as much of a fan of this gauntlet match as I was. I'm not so much a fan of Bayley being dispatched as easily and as quickly as she was. But you know, I'm at the point with Bayley where maybe it's just the best thing to do at this point. Just tear her down completely before you can build her back up. It's the only way to go at this point. Mickie James lasted a little bit longer, but not much. Nia took her out as well. Dana Brooke was out next. Dana Brooke came out. She did a cartwheel and then promptly got kicked in the face and pinned, which is exactly what Dana Brooke should be doing. The Emma thing kind of ticked me off. She didn't last very long. Emma just came back. She came back. She got hurt again, but she came back. You would think, all right, do something with her. Make her into something. But she comes in and again, just like nothing. Nothing. They finished her off within a matter of minutes. They've done a horrible job of making her out to be any kind of a threat. So she was treated like a joke here. And then out came Sasha Banks, reigniting the feud that you thought you did not want to see, but WWE was going to give it to you again anyway. And you know what? They told a nice story. They gave it time to play out. This probably went 15 minutes just with Nia and Sasha all by themselves. And the crowd was into it. The crowd stuck with them. Nia went for another Samoan drop. Sasha turned it sort of into a, we'll call it a modified bank statement from a standing position. Got Nia down to one knee. And then Nia very weakly tapped out to give Sasha the win. And so Sasha Banks will now challenge Alexa Bliss at Great Balls of Fire for the Raw Women's Championship. Kurt Angle came out to raise Sasha's hand. Alexa came out to hold the belt up in Sasha's face. Sasha gave her a drop kick, and then she posed with the title to end the show. I had been hoping for months, as you well know, for the build to a Sasha Bayley match at SummerSlam in Brooklyn and tell the whole story, 2 years after their classic match at NXT TakeOver. But no more. No more. There's no way they can do that match now. Maybe WrestleMania next year. But not SummerSlam. The match at SummerSlam has to be Sasha and Alexa. It should be Sasha and Alexa. I mean, let's see what happens next Sunday. I guess it would be the rematch since they're doing the first match next weekend. But Sasha and Alexa is the way to go. I think that'll be the hot women's program heading into SummerSlam. And you know what? If Paige, there's a name I haven't mentioned recently. If Paige, who I saw was having tests done to check on the progress of her neck, she may be close to coming back. If Paige gets cleared to return by then, and it sounds like she might, you know what you can do? The Raw after SummerSlam in Brooklyn at the Barclays Center. Paige can come out and she can go after either one of the, whoever the champion is. Or you know what? It doesn't even have to be the champion. She can come out and go after either one of those women. She can go after Alexa and be the babyface. She can go after Sasha and be the heel. You have babyface Sasha against heel Paige. But either way, I think if Paige comes back, that would give, whatever your thoughts are on Paige, that would give that women's division, I think, a nice shot in the arm as far as star power. I mean, in that division, Paige was a star before she got hurt and went away. So to get her back would be a positive for the women's division on Raw. Now, SmackDown Live, I ran a Twitter poll with over 2,100 votes, 52% thumbs up, only 11% thumbs down, 37% of you did not watch. I thought this was a pretty basic show, aside from giving away a Money in the Bank match for free on TV. We had the Hype Bros, who Daniel Bryan had said would have to beat the Usos in a non-title match first if they wanted to get a shot at the belts. Well, they ain't getting a shot at the belts because they lost to the Usos. The New Day came out. They started rapping with the Usos, and the two teams apparently are going to have a rap battle on SmackDown this Tuesday, hosted by Wale. Wale will host the rap battle. You know what? John Cena and The Big Show had a pretty entertaining battle rap on SmackDown many, many, many years ago, and the Usos have been killing it on the mic lately, so this actually could be really good. I am going to give this a chance. They do segments like this sometimes that are so ungodly horrendous, but I think this one could actually be pretty good. The Fashion Vice skit that they did with Breezango and The Ascension, I actually liked. I thought that was one of the better ones they've done. And as I say that here out loud, I realize, did I actually just say that? Did I actually just say that I enjoyed a segment with the Ascension. Am I feeling okay? I thought I was. Maybe not, though. Maybe I have walking pneumonia or something. But I enjoyed it. Naomi pinned Lana in yet another match for the SmackDown Women's title. Lana immediately hit her move, the seated spinebuster, but Naomi kicked out. Naomi then followed that up with a split-legged moonsault for the win. So this went probably not even 2 minutes. Now I see Daniel Bryan on Twitter is claiming that Lana's shoulder was up off the mat before the three count, and so Lana is going to get another title shot on SmackDown this Tuesday. They're just giving these things out like candy now, aren't they? And if I didn't know any better, I'm looking at this thing here, if I didn't know any better, I would say that they're setting up for a double turn. Between Carmella coming out the night that she won the briefcase the first time, and distracting Lana, because if I remember correctly, Lana was on the offense. She was in control of the match, not Naomi, when Carmella came out, and it was Lana who was distracted, and ultimately it ended up costing her the match. Fast forward here, Lana's shoulder was up, and so she was unfairly screwed out of a win, here in this match. Then you have Naomi on TV acting all cocky, like, why is this woman even getting a shot? She doesn't deserve it. On social media, she's talking about how bored she is now with facing Lana at this point. I'm just saying, it sure looks to me like we may be in for a double turn between these two women. We had a segment in the ring with Blandy Orton and Shane McMahon where Orton demanded a rematch with Jinder Mahal. Shane McMahon said he'll get his rematch. Okay, you'll get your rematch, but Jinder gets to pick the stip. And so out came Jinder Mahal, and he announced that he was choosing a stipulation made famous by his idol, the Great Khali. And Batista is no doubt crying somewhere. And he confirmed the rumor that I talked about right here on the Sound Off last week, which is that their match at Battleground will be a Punjabi prison match. We got our first formal Mike and Maria Kanellis appearance here on SmackDown, but they were quickly interrupted by Sami Zayn's theme music, and Sami walked right by them on his way to the ring. Maria was none too pleased with this, so that may give us a sense of what Sami's next program might be. He came out for a match with Baron Corbin, which Corbin won with the End of Days. No run-in or distraction by Mike and Maria, just a straight-up match. Sami lost. Meanwhile, they showed Nakamura backstage watching the match on a monitor when Dasha Fuentes walks up to him. She calls him Shin, by the way. That's how close those two must be. She doesn't even call him Shinsuke. She's like, hey, Shin. She says the WWE Universe wants to see a match between Nakamura and Corbin. Really? Nobody asked me that question. Am I not part of the universe? Am I in some outer galaxy here? Nakamura said something I honestly couldn't understand what he said. He said something. And I've seen the rumors of Nakamura possibly winning the Money in the Bank briefcase from Corbin because Vince McMahon has soured on Baron Corbin. Soured on Baron Corbin? He won the briefcase 2 weeks ago. Where does this come from? He just won the briefcase. I know Vince changes his mind every 5 seconds, but I find that hard to believe. Nakamura is not winning the briefcase from him. We had Carmella, Natalya, Tamina, Charlotte, and Becky Lynch in a Money in the Bank ladder match. This is pretty good. This was pretty good. I think I liked the first match they had a little bit better before that finish, but this was a good match, I thought. They put a lot of hard work, a lot of effort here in this match. James Ellsworth, who wasn't supposed to be there, he was barred from ringside. He came out anyway. He came out through the crowd, and he was doing exactly what he did at Money in the Bank at the pay-per-view, helping Carmella climbing the ladder. He was going to unhook it and drop the briefcase down into her hands, but Becky Lynch came into the ring. She tipped over the ladder. Ellsworth got crotched on the top rope, so he was out. Becky started to climb when all of a sudden Carmella comes up from behind, and she goes after Lynch's knee. She actually hit her knee, I think with the ladder or a chair, but she went after Becky's knee, and Becky was hurt, and so Carmella climbs. She unhooks the briefcase. Surprise, surprise. Just like I said last week, as predicted, Carmella re-wins the Money in the Bank briefcase. So the end result is the same, but hopefully they popped a nice rating for the match. So this Tuesday, they're billing this as a very special episode of SmackDown. Of course, this is the July 4th show, so this is probably not going to do very well. But they're loading it up. We have the return of free agent John Cena. And I'm thinking it's probably too early to set something up with him and Jinder because Jinder's still feuding with Orton. So if we prefer, if it's not Jinder, if Cena's going to come back and talk about someone or start a feud with somebody, it probably won't be Jinder Mahal just yet. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking to myself, okay, who could John Cena wrestle at SummerSlam if not Jinder Mahal? I still feel like all roads lead to Cena beating Jinder, but if it's not Jinder at SummerSlam, then who is it? And I'm looking now, they're setting up a feud with Corbin and Nakamura. I wouldn't do that. They were talking about that's the match the universe wants to see, not my universe. I don't really have this great interest in seeing that match. You know what match I would like to see that I think would be pretty cool? John Cena against Nakamura at SummerSlam. That would be a big match. That would be a big match. Now, I know what some people are thinking. They're like, are you nuts? Have you lost your mind? Do you know how this ends? Yeah, it ends with Nakamura beating John Cena. That's the only way for it to end. Could they not do that? Of course, but I would take the chance and just have them set up a match with Nakamura and Cena with the idea that they'll in the end they'll do the right thing. Cuz they've been pushing Nakamura like a big deal. John Cena doesn't need the win, he doesn't need the help. He can have a big match and lose. And then come back and win his next feud and feud with Rusev or somebody. Because, you know, Rusev is on his way back. I don't know where the hell he's been. He should be back any week. We keep saying that. We never see him. They could always do something coming out of that with Cena and Rusev. But in terms of setting up a big match for SummerSlam, I think Cena and Nakamura would be a huge attraction. So we'll see. We'll see what free agent John Cena has in mind. Again, they're calling him free agent for a reason. So it's very possible that they'll do something with him and maybe a Raw brand star. That's also very possible. I guess we'll find out. We have the Women's Championship rematch, part three, between Naomi and Lana, and an Independence Day Battle Royal to determine the number one contender for Kevin Owens' United States Championship. I would expect AJ Styles to win this Battle Royal and to get the title match at Battleground. We'll find out on Tuesday. They're doing their best. The one thing I will say that I like about this is they're actually promoting stuff in advance. We have all of that, plus the rap battle with Wale hosting with the New Day and the Usos. So they're hyping a lot of things up for the show, which is all you can ask. I don't know how many people are actually going to be around at 8 o'clock on July 4th watching SmackDown. But they're certainly doing their part to try to get people to watch.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Kairi Hojo was officially added to the Mae Young Classic this week. I said it months ago. There's your winner right there. Right? What did I say? Put her in the tournament, let her win it, and then let her be the one to take the title from Asuka. They did give her a slight name change. Her new name is Kairi Sane. Unless they pronounce it differently, like Sane or something. It was a few weeks before I stopped calling Asuka Asuka. So it may take some getting used to if it's going to be pronounced in some other way. I called John Cena John Cena for a while, first time I saw his name. The fuck should I know? But she made the announcement in a pre-recorded message that they aired on the video screen at the WWE House Show in Tokyo this week. WWE.com did a write-up on her signing referring to her nickname as the Pirate Princess and a glimmer of hope when it comes to her famous elbow drop. Remember I said the rumor many weeks ago was that they had told her to find a new move because Bayley already uses the elbow drop and they didn't want her using it. This is what they said in the story here on WWE's own website. Formerly known by the alias Kairi Hojo, Sane has wrestled for 5 years and was a multiple-time champion in the Japanese organization Stardom. Her pirate persona is inspired by her elite background in yachting. Before entering the mat game, Sane competed in the Yachting World Championship and was considered an Olympic hopeful. Though Sane has often carried a spyglass to the ring, it's her highlight reel-worthy diving elbow drop, thought by many to be the most beautiful in the world, that has navigated her to many milestone victories. You would think that they would not be putting over her elbow as being the best in the world unless they were going to let her use the damn thing. So I'm hopeful that means they are not forcing her to change it, or if they were, that they've backed off. I know the .com team isn't always in sync with the writers. One hand doesn't always know what the other hand is doing, but it would be incredibly stupid after running something like that on their own website to tease it here and then to not let her use it. To talk about how she's got the most beautiful elbow drop in the world and then have her change her finishing move to like a diamond cutter or something. So here's hoping that some intelligent people over there know what they have in her and they let her do her thing. This was Mauro Ranallo's first show as lead announcer for NXT. I thought he worked just fine with Nigel and with Percy Watson. Doesn't take much to work well with Percy Watson. You just do 98% of the talking and let him chime in with something pointless every few minutes. So I thought they worked fine together. Oni Lorcan and Hideo Itami. I talked last week on the show when I talked about the tapings, how Hideo Itami may have suffered a broken nose. And it was in this match. So the bell rings. Oni Lorcan comes like a bat out of hell, out of nowhere, with like a diving European uppercut. And he connected a little too well with it. So right away, there's blood pouring out of Itami's nose. The referee stops the match. There's blood all over Itami's hand. It looks like he broke. Now, maybe he didn't actually break it, but even the announcers were saying that he broke his nose. So the match was called off. I'm surprised they left all of this in the show. I was kind of curious how they were going to edit this because I knew they came back out later in the taping to redo the match, but they kept all of this in there. And they did come back out later on, and they had a hell of a match. They had a hell of a stiff match here. Itami gave it right back to him. By the end of the match, he was bleeding again, but they said that they had cotton balls. He had cotton balls shoved so far up his nose to try to stop the bleeding. But by the end of the match, he was already bleeding again. But these two, it's a lot of fun to watch these two in the ring. And in the end, Oni was on the receiving end of a go-to-sleep. Hideo Itami gets the win. He calls out Cassius Ono when the match is over. And Itami and Ono are face-to-face. All of a sudden, Nikki Cross jumps up on the apron, distracts them when Alexander Wolf and Killian Dane from Sanity attack them both from behind. This is all to set up a tag team match for NXT this Wednesday with Cassius Ono and Hideo Itami against Sanity. I think we all know where this is heading. It's too bad that Cassius Ono is too stupid to realize it. William Regal was in his office for a segment here on the show. He had both Heavy Machinery and the NXT Tag Team Champions, the Authors of Pain, with Paul Ellering. And Regal announced that in 2 weeks' time, Heavy Machinery would in fact get a tag team title opportunity. I was completely distracted the entire time by Otis. I could not take my eyes off this guy. He is like nobody else on this roster. He's just such a unique looking guy. I've said before, he looks like a walking King Kong Bundy LJN figure, the way he's got his arms out. He can't put his arms down by his side. And the whole time, he's looking at someone off camera. I don't know if it was somebody giving him cues or if it's just part of his character. He's all nervous and he's looking around. But it looked like he was eyeballing somebody off camera the entire time. It was very distracting. But in any event, we have that match coming up in 2 weeks. Now, next week, this Wednesday, is the NXT Championship match with Bobby Roode defending against Roderick Strong. So that's going to be a big match coming up on TV this week. The main event here on this show, which is really what this show is all about, was a last woman standing match for the NXT Women's Championship, Asuka defending against Nikki Cross. I thought this was, of all the women's matches this week, and there was a lot of great women's action here on the shows, this was my favorite of all of the matches. I thought this was the best overall of all the matches. These women beat the hell out of each other. At one point, Nikki Cross pulled out a bunch of chairs from underneath the ring. There was like a pile of chairs on the outside, and they were slamming each other on them and suplexing each other on them. But there was one point in this match where I thought obviously it's a taped match, and we didn't hear about any serious Asuka injury coming out of the match. But holy shit, there was a point where Nikki Cross gave Asuka, I think it was a sunset, it might have been a sunset flip powerbomb from the apron, down, it was supposed to be down onto the pile of chairs on the outside, but the camera was positioned so perfectly on the ground right where Asuka's head landed. It looked like her head bounced off the very edge of the ramp. Oh, I thought she was concussed. I thought she was knocked out. And for all intents and purposes, the match should have ended right then and there. It's unbelievable that she even came back from that. But my God, did that look sick. That was... I'll tell you something. They avoided a major catastrophe there because how she didn't crack her skull open, I'll never know. That was very scary. They ended up brawling up the rampway over by where the announcers are positioned. The announcers got the hell out of there. So a hell of a first night for Mauro Ranallo. The guy literally threw his headset down and went running for his life. And a ladder got set up. And Nikki Cross is climbing the ladder. Asuka, though, manages to get back up to her feet. She's going up after Nikki Cross. She hits a suplex off the ladder through the announce desk. This was a hell of a spot. Hell of a bump here both women took. And at that point, they were both out. And I thought, well, this is going to end in a no contest here. Neither woman is going to be able to make it back up before the count of 10. Asuka barely at the last possible second got up to her feet. And so Asuka wins. She retains her championship. The closest that I think she's ever been positioned as having lost her championship. Or at least going to some sort of a non-decision in a singles match, but she made it back up just in the nick of time. These two had a hell of a match. I'm not going to give you the blow-by-blow. You need to go back and watch it for yourself because it was that good. And Asuka's reign of terror continues over the women's division on NXT. Who can stop her? I can think of one person. We'll see if Triple H has the same name in mind. Impact. Impact Wrestling. You know, I say each week, well, not every week, but I do this segment, Say Something Nice About Impact. And I thought for a moment that I wasn't going to be able to do it anymore because of this name change I'm going to talk about here. But I guess the TV show is still called Impact, so I could still keep my segment. I can keep my gimmick going here. But yes, Impact Wrestling is no more. They will officially be rebranded, I guess, as of tonight, as of this weekend, as Global Force Wrestling. Going forward, after Anthem acquired the GFW brand this past week. Now, of course, GFW has been all over Impact TV for months now. So you ask yourself, what changes here? What's the big deal? It really isn't a big deal. It's more of a formality than anything else. But you look at this and you say to yourself, GFW and Impact, for all intents and purposes for weeks now, have felt like one and the same, right? Different titles and different initials, but they've already been on TV. It all feels the same. And Joey on Twitter, I think, summed it up best to me when he called it the equivalent of walking into a bank and cashing a check you wrote to yourself. And I thought that was a good analogy. And by the way, I would not advise anybody to do that, so please don't. Now comes a report from the Tennessean, which is, I believe, the main paper over there in Tennessee, that after this weekend's Slammiversary pay-per-view, which is tonight, Impact Wrestling will be no more. So Impact Wrestling, TNA, it is all officially dead. TNA is officially dead. And it will be Global Force Wrestling from here on out. Although the name of the TV show, like I said, will still be called Impact. It will be GFW Impact. As of the pay-per-view tonight, all of the Impact and GFW titles I will basically be merged together. My understanding is they're working on new belts. We might even see them tonight. So yeah, GFW lives, and here I thought, I had a funeral for GFW months ago, only to see them pop up out of the casket. Jeff Jarrett apparently now has an ownership stake in this company now after this move. Look at this guy. Look at this fucker. They call Ric Flair Slick Rick. Now we can call Jarrett Jazzy Jeff. Jazzy Jeff managed to pull off the impossible here. He finally got his long-awaited TV deal. Basically, GFW now has a TV deal with Spike. With the Pop. He wishes he had a TV deal with Spike. He has a TV deal with Pop now. So yeah, sly fox that Jeff Jarrett is. I take my hat off to him. I still want to know how he tampered with that ignition breathalyzer device last year from the arrest report that Rebbe Hardy posted on Twitter from the DUI. But kudos to him for pulling off this coup. A coup of Impact Wrestling is now complete. And look, the one good thing I will say about this is that those TNA initials and the Impact Wrestling brand name were so poisoned, were so damaged, they should have been changed years ago. Getting rid of them is a good thing. The GFW name doesn't mean anything to anybody outside of the hardest of hardcore fans. It means nothing. Their job now is to build up the GFW brand name and make it mean something. And you know, they think they're going to do that by bringing in people tonight. I know they have a bunch of celebrities that are going to be on the pay-per-view tonight, sports players, that sort of thing. But, you know, that's on them to try to create a buzz around GFW and turn it into something that people will recognize and people will want to see. To that end, I say good luck. But getting rid of the Impact name and the TNA name and everything that had to do with that old branding is something that had to happen. So that's a good thing. At least this, if nothing else, washes some of the stink off. And like I said, now it's up to them to, you know, put a product out that catches fire. Now, Slammiversary is tonight. It's one of their bigger pay-per-view, one of their only pay-per-views of the year. Scott Steiner is on this pay-per-view. He is, of course, teaming up with Josh Matthews against Jeremy Borash and Joseph Park. Scott Steiner did a conference call to promote his appearance at Slammiversary tonight. He did a conference call, and it went about as well as you would expect a Scott Steiner conference call to go. He talked about Hulk Hogan trying to press charges against him. He talked about his now infamous match with Triple H at the 2003 Royal Rumble. He talked about political correctness. And he talked about the WWE Hall of Fame. And I wanted to pull the stuff he said about the Hall of Fame. Here's what he had to say about that and why we will not be seeing him in the Hall of Fame anytime soon. This is what he said about the Hall of Fame. He says, I'm not going into the WWE Hall of Fame. I'm not going somewhere where there's nowhere to go. Where's it at? I'm not going somewhere where if I get into some trouble, I can't call 911. I can't have a beacon call to the Coast Guard. Because who knows? It could be in Atlantis for all I know. He's just going on and on. He's like, so basically, you know, again, the Hall of Fame doesn't exist. It's all a figment of Vince McMahon's imagination. There is no physical Hall of Fame. And he's worried that, you know, if he goes to the WWE Hall of Fame, which doesn't exist, that he may get trapped in some vortex, I guess, like the Bermuda Triangle or something. And he may not be able to call for help to get himself out of there, which is a valid concern to have. It is a valid concern for the man to have, but it gets better. It gets even better. So this is what he continued to say. He says, it could be underwater. It could be in parts unknown. I'm not going there. It's a joke. It's non-existent. It would be better to put the WWE Hall of Fame on the moon. At least then you could look up at the moon at night and say, wow, look at the WWE. Oh, I'm sorry. I have tears in my eyes right now. I have tears, literal tears in my eyes. He says, at least then you could say, wow, look at the WWE Hall of Fame. Oh my God. Scott Steiner. I'm so happy I'm not doing this on video right now. Scott Steiner is just a wonderful human being. He is a wonderful man. There is nobody like him. There will never be another one like him. Yeah. So there you go. But wait, it gets even better. He wasn't done. Then came this. He says, it's a joke. Where are the statues? Where is the statue of Ric Flair or the Macho Man? You'll never see the statue of the Macho Man because it never leaves Stephanie's bedroom. Wow. They actually do have a statue, by the way, for Flair. He probably doesn't know that. It's just not in the Hall of Fame because there is no Hall of Fame. But there is, in fact, a Ric Flair statue, I think, was it WrestleMania this year? It might have been unveiled. So that was a portion of what Scott Steiner had to say on his Slammiversary conference call, which somehow devolved into this whole diatribe on the WWE Hall of Fame, which I'm sure must have pleased the officials over at Impact to no end. But we should all be so grateful that we have Scott Steiner around still after all these years to entertain us as only he can. Lucha Underground. I got to run through this real quick here because we're running low on time. But we had a bunch of Cueto Cup matches here on this episode, including Mil Muertes and Katrina, who have not yet been featured since Lucha Underground came back. We saw them here on this show. In fact, Mil Muertes beat Veneno, I guess it is, to advance in his Cueto Cup match. Complete squash, by the way. He absolutely destroyed this guy. Made short work of him, pinned him with the flatliner. And then after the match, Katrina gave him the lick of death. Somebody tweeted me and they said, would it be worth it for you, if you were in the shoes of someone like Veneno, to take the kind of beating that he did just to get the lick of death by Katrina? Which, the answer is yes, of course. It's a stupid question, that is. Paul London, we saw him. Paul London, of course, is a member, or the leader, of the White Rabbit Tribe. He took on Vibora, the giant lizard man from the Lizard Tribe. I'm trying to keep track of all the tribes here. We have the Lizard Tribe and the Black Rabbit, or the White Rabbit Tribe. Maybe there's a Black. We have the Black Lotus Triad. That's what I'm thinking of. We haven't seen them in a while. So many different factions here. It's like, it reminds me of WWF in the fall of 1997. You had the skinheads, and you had the Barriquas, and you had the Nation, and I think there was another one too, the Canadians. You had a lot of different factions. Vibora is a big dude. He's every bit of 7 feet tall. I don't know what he looks like under the mask. I'd keep the mask, because the mask actually looks pretty badass. But he looks like the kind of guy that'll end up in WWE one day. They would take one look at him and they would be in heaven. At one point in this match, Paul London, who's absolutely out of his mind, not just on this show, but if you've listened to past shoot interviews with him, the man is crazy. He's out of his mind. Talented, but nuts. At one point, he grabbed Cobra Moon, who was outside in Vibora's corner, and he grabbed Cobra Moon and held her hostage with a carrot. He put a carrot to her head. Everybody popped huge for it. Vibora was not very amused by this, though. And in the end, Paul London got the win. How did he get the win? Well, he got the win because when they were outside the ring, and there were two other members, as you know, of the Rabbit Tribe. Right? There's three of them. So I think Saltador is one, and I forgot the name of the other one. But they were underneath the ring, because at one point they came out and they immediately went back under the ring. So we knew they were there. Well, when Vibora was trying to climb back into the ring to beat the referee's count, one of the members, if not actually both members of the White Rabbit Tribe, reached and grabbed his feet. And he was unable to climb back into the ring in time. And so Paul London gets the win and he advances here in this tournament. I think that means he faces... Is it Mil Muertes? Does he face Mil Muertes? I don't have the brackets in front of me. He might be wrestling Mil Muertes next. We had Taya against Joey Ryan in another Cueto Cup tournament match here. Joey Ryan, at his sleaziest, takes the lollipop out of his mouth here at the beginning of the match. He offers it to Taya. And Taya smacks it away. And by the way, there's some drama going on involving Taya and AAA, because she was, I guess, the AAA Women's Champion. And apparently they, without even informing her, stripped her of the championship. I saw some tweets from her yesterday. She was being asked about that. And they said, hey, what's up? And she said, yeah, they didn't even tell me about it. Isn't that nice? So there's some political BS going on with AAA right now. And Taya, I don't have the whole story, but that could be something to follow. But Taya beat Joey Ryan here in this match. They actually had a decently competitive one-on-one match. Again, I'm not a huge fan of the man-on-woman stuff. But when, Taya's a tough girl. Joey Ryan, you don't look at him and think tough, right? That's not really his character. If anything, Taya comes off as more of a badass than he does. So here's a case, here's a situation where I didn't really notice it too much. Didn't bother me too much. They had a good match. And Taya ended up jumping up in the air. She actually hit a Northern Light suplex, rolled through, and then immediately jumped up and landed on his chest with a double foot stomp and got the pin. Pretty impressive. So Taya advances. We got a locker room scene where Mil Muertes, after his earlier destruction, is now wearing a suit and tie. Which is odd to me that, of all people, Mil Muertes, at the end of his matches, puts a suit on. That really was very bizarre to me. I would like to know where he's going. Is he going to a function? Is he going to a ball? Maybe a masquerade ball, perhaps, with Katrina? I'd love to know. So he's about to leave when all of a sudden, Jeremiah Crane, remember him? Former Sammy Callahan. He attacks Mil Muertes with a chair. And he's very jealous because he knows Katrina. They have a history together. And he says to Mil Muertes, "She's mine." Actually, she's mine, but I'm not going to say anything here. But he put the chair across Mill's throat and destroyed his throat. I guess we didn't actually see it happen, but he left him laying. We got another great video package. They're really hyping the hell out of this Johnny Mundo, Rey Mysterio, Lucha Underground title match that's coming up in the next few weeks. And they had interviews with Chavo Guerrero Jr. and Prince Puma and Matt Stryker. They call him Cage. Good stuff. Main event was awesome. Main event was Jeremiah Crane against Killshot in another Cueto Cup match. These guys absolutely destroyed each other. This was crazy, this match. Too much stuff to even go through here. But at one point, I will say, Killshot dropped Crane on the apron with a Death Valley driver. Oof, that looked brutal. And Dante Fox made an appearance up in the rafters. So after this incredible back and forth match, these guys are just killing it. They're killing each other. There's Dante Fox up in the rafters. And that distracted Killshot. Jeremiah Crane capitalized on that, gave him the cranial contusion, which is a double underhook spike pile driver, basically. Kind of like the cop killer, in a way. Although the cop killer that Homicide does, I guess he's got him from behind. It's almost like a vertebraker. This wasn't a vertebraker, but either way, very effective, very brutal, and enough to pick up the win. So Jeremiah Crane advances. Katrina standing up on the staircase. She had a stare down with Crane as the credits appeared on the screen. And then the final closing scene of the show was back in Dario Cueto's office. Dario is in there with somebody who I could have sworn for a good 90 seconds I thought was Son of Havoc. And then I realized there's something off about this guy. This is not Son of Havoc. And it's not. It's Son of Madness. It's a new character that they're introducing to the show. And he wants in the Cueto Cup. And it just so happens that the only person left for him to face is Son of Havoc. He even asks him, he goes, "Hey, what should I tell Melissa to announce you? Like, where are you from?" And he says, "The Open Road." So he's got some beef of some kind with Son of Havoc. He looked just like him. He got the big bushy beard, same outfit, same voice that they, post-produced and altered to make him sound like Nails back in the day. So yeah, we have a new character here, Son of Madness. He'll face Son of Havoc next week, and that was it. That was Lucha Underground. So they're moving things along with the tournament. Nothing overly special happened. But the main event with Jeremiah Crane and Dante Fox, you ought to go find that match, because that was a crazy match. It was really sad to hear that Matt Capitelli, one of the winners from season 3 of Tough Enough, him and John Morrison, Johnny Mundo, who I just mentioned, they won it the same year. He was just diagnosed, was Capitelli, with a recurrence of the brain tumor. I would say brain cancer, because they have to do surgery and find out what's going on. But the brain tumor that he had about a decade ago that I think they found to be malignant. He had surgery. He was in remission. Well, the brain tumor is back, and it's more aggressive than it was the first time. Not only that, but part of the tumor is inoperable. And that is just terrible news. He underwent brain surgery. I think he may have already underwent brain surgery this week. If not, he's about to remove a portion of the tumor to be tested to find out what they're dealing with here and determine how best to treat it moving forward. That comes directly from him and his wife on Facebook. So best wishes to him. You know, getting a cancer diagnosis is bad enough, but then for it to come back years later is just a double kick to the nuts. I also read that Dave Meltzer's father, Mr. Meltzer, was just diagnosed with advanced pancreatic cancer. And apparently he doesn't have much time left. best wishes to them as well. You know, if you've been following my Twitter this week, you know my family's had our own issues with my mom's cancer and dealing with these craven insurance companies who don't want to authorize a certain test that her doctor says she needs because she hasn't been feeling well and her counts are a little weird. And so meanwhile, time is wasting. We can't get a simple test that she's had in the past that she needs, life or death, potentially. And the insurance company wants to play games. So cancer is awful enough. To have this added stress on top of that is unconscionable. It is absolutely unconscionable. And I hope that none of you ever have to go through what we're going through right now, because it's bad. It's bad. All right, so after that awful news, I didn't mean to bring the show to a halt, but there was a lot of bad cancer-related news this week. So let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Mr. Jacob, shout out to Mr. Jacob on Twitter, wanted me to just talk briefly about my meeting with the former CEO of Marvel the other day, which I'm happy to talk about, something positive after a week of a lot of negative shit. But yeah, I was at a networking event with a client of mine on Tuesday, and one of the speakers at the event was the former CEO of Marvel, this guy Peter Cuneo, who was the CEO of Marvel Entertainment. Then he was the vice chairman of the board there for a number of years. And I was able to get some FaceTime with him when the event was over. They had a cocktail reception up on the rooftop after. And again, this guy has made a career out of turning companies around. That's kind of what he's known for. So he was the president at one point of Black & Decker. He was the CEO of Remington. Very successful and just known for turning six or seven different companies around in his day. And it was just fascinating to hear him talk about that. And I mean, there's too much to get into here, but I went over to him at the cocktail party after. We talked for like 40 minutes. And it's pretty remarkable. When he came aboard at Marvel, which would have been 1999, the company had already filed for bankruptcy a few years earlier. So Marvel wasn't doing all that great. And at one point, I guess their stock, they were as low as 96 cents a share. He took over as CEO. It was a three-year turnaround. He wasn't the CEO for that many years. But he took over. By the time Disney acquired Marvel many years later for $4 billion, which would have been in 2009, I think they were up to like $54 a share. And once Disney bought out Marvel, that's when his stint ended with the company and he moved on. But it was funny. He was all, but again, so very impressive stuff. And it was funny. He told some stories also about working with Robert Downey Jr., like on the Iron Man movie, and the decision to cast him, which a lot of people were against. I won't get into all of that, but, you know, above all else, like, what was it that really helped Marvel? That was one of the questions that he was asked. And it was licensing. He said, look, you know, the movie deals and everything, you know, we make a certain number. That number doesn't really change regardless of how well the movie does. Like, he's going into all the specifics of how this works. But he said, at the end of the day, it's all about licensing. And this is what they were not doing. I can't imagine Marvel today not, you know, licensing you know, out and having all these different products, but this is just something they were not doing back then. And he said it was all about licensing the characters in the Marvel universe, the toys, the back to school stuff, all these things he said we're not doing. We need to be doing this. Slapping Spider-Man and Hulk on anything and everything you could think of. So I thought that was just, it was fascinating to hear him talk about that. And so the next time you see one of those John Cena garden gnomes, remember those? And you laugh at it, which I did too the first time I saw it, and you say, why does something like this exist? Who the hell would buy this? Oh, believe me, someone will. And they'll make a lot of money off it. So anyway, that was my meeting with the Marvel CEO. Trevor, from Missouri, I'd like to hear your take on the possibility of WrestleMania in St. Louis one day. I feel like the only reason WrestleMania has not been there yet is because of Vince's beef with Rams owner Stan Kroenke. I didn't realize that Stan Kroenke owned the Rams. I knew he owned the Denver Nuggets. I did not realize that he also owned the Rams. So, yeah, I guess that could be an issue, but no, that has nothing to do with why WrestleMania hasn't come to St. Louis. St. Louis, if they want it bad enough, they'll make a bid. That's what cities do now. You make a big presentation, you roll out the red carpet, you make them feel wanted, you make them feel welcome. Maybe you give them some tax breaks or something. And if St. Louis wants WrestleMania bad enough, I'm sure one day they'll get WrestleMania. I don't know, as far as attractions in St. Louis, I'm not sure what, you know, what else there is. I mean, I was in St. Louis once for like a cup of coffee. Like I was there for not even two full days. It was on a business trip. I did get to see the Gateway Arch, which was kind of cool. I didn't get to do much else. I was at a mall there for a client event. One of the big malls, made like a couple of store openings. So that was my brief time in St. Louis. I mean, the people there seem nice, but I mean, what else is there to do there? I mean, I'm trying to think because they go to a lot of these touristy cities, right? Orlando, Miami, New Orleans. I can see them going to Vegas when that football stadium is there. So in St. Louis, or even a place like Indianapolis, you know, Indianapolis has been rumored for a WrestleMania in the future. You know, you got to factor that in too. I mean, what else is there for people to do? I don't live in St. Louis, so I'm sure if you do, then you can share with me all the different attractions that are there. I know that it's the home of, you know, Blandy Orton, and it's got the Gateway Arch, and they have the Cardinals, and screw the Cardinals, by the way. So that's what I know of St. Louis, but if they want it bad enough, they'll bid, and maybe one day they'll get it. But believe me, WWE is not blacklisting any cities because Vince has a beef with the owner of the sports team or something like that. Bored Vegas writes in, I was happy to hear Mauro Ranallo was making his way to NXT and tuned in for that fact. First time watching NXT in a while, and the first thing I saw was the Velveteen Dream. His act reminded me of WCW in the late 90s and WWF before it went PG with characters like Val Venus. His act is super flamboyant but seems authentic. When he makes it to the main roster, do you see WWE toning him down to fit their PG product? If they do this right, he could be a real star. You know who he reminds me of? He reminds me of Orlando Jordan. That's who he reminds me of, only without pouring milk all over himself like they had him doing in TNA. But that's who I think of when I look at him and this character that he's doing, and even just the hair. I think of Orlando Jordan. And there's some gold dust mixed in there, maybe. Yes, he's very flamboyant, and that's, you know, I don't know if the point is to make you uncomfortable. I don't know exactly, you know, what he's trying to do with it. What I've noticed is he's not bad in the ring. Now, remember, when he was on Tough Enough, he was on that last season of Tough Enough, Patrick Clark, but unlike a lot of the other people on that show, he had some wrestling experience before he went to Tough Enough. He was one of the few people, if not maybe the only one, who had like legitimate indie wrestling experience going into that show. So it's not as though he came into that show not a wrestling fan or no experience whatsoever. So obviously he's taken from that, and he's taken from his training at the PC. He's pretty good. He's got a pretty good elbow drop off the top rope. So yeah, I mean, he can carry it in the ring, and if he can devote himself to the character and have the character end of it taken care of, he could be a big star. I don't see him necessarily being a WWE champion, but who's to say? Who's to say that he'll go through his entire career with this gimmick? This could just be a gimmick to get noticed. A lot of guys are doing a gimmick in NXT, and believe me, when they go to the main roster, it's a very different story. The Drifter, I mean, there's an example of somebody who was, you know, would get groans when he would come out in NXT. And as somebody on Twitter mentioned to me this week, it's like, wow, he's actually gotten over more on the main roster than he was in NXT. But he is essentially doing the same gimmick. But not everybody does. I mean, Tyler Breeze, look at the Tyler Breeze character when he was in NXT. He was a fashionista, right? You couldn't even touch him. If the referee touched him, like to break him up in the corner, he yelled at the referees, like, don't touch me, you know, and he would come from a seasonal residence in this island or this place or that place. And now, I mean, look at him now. He's playing almost a totally different character now. So you never know when you go from NXT to the main roster how it's going to be. If you're a big star like a Samoa Joe or a Nakamura or a Bobby Roode, you're going to be the same person. You're going to be the same character. Somebody like him, who knows? It doesn't really seem like they would let him do much in the way of risque stuff on the main roster, so he may have to. Look, Goldust is back doing stuff that Goldust was doing 20 years ago. And you know, what Patrick Clark is doing with this gimmick is very similar to Goldust, so there's already somebody on the main roster doing some of the stuff that he's doing. So I don't know. I don't know when he'll hit the main roster or in what character he may be in at that point. But he's an athletic guy. He's a talented guy. He could be a solid player, I think, on that roster. And here's the other thing, by the way. He was easily hateable on that Tough Enough show, and that's a good quality to have when you can be, when you can get people to hate you or feel some sort of emotion for you one way or the other. That's a good thing. So that's another reason why I think he'll do well. Clayton from Wichita, Kansas. There's no doubt the impact that Steve Austin had on the wrestling industry. But in his later years, his character seemed to be getting stale. His post-wrestling career as an authority figure was somewhat laughable. For instance, his Sheriff of Raw gimmick. Do you think Austin's career would have thrived in later years had he not gotten hurt? Or was it better that his career was cut short to preserve his legacy? I think Austin would have done very well doing the part-time thing like we see Rock doing and Brock, and only being used for like big mega matches against guys like Cena and Punk. Maybe today it would be against a guy like Joe, like saving him for matches like that. Because, I mean, physically, he couldn't do much more than that. Beyond the physical aspect of it, I mean, can you imagine, though? Think about this, right? So let's say that Austin never did get seriously hurt, but he was scaling back and he was only going to be part-time, right? Beyond the physical aspect of it, can you imagine these people even 10 years ago, whatever, with Vince and the writers even back then, having to write for Stone Cold every single week? How awful that probably would have been. I have no faith in these people that they would have been able to come up with anything for this guy. And Austin has always been very critical of creative and making sure that, you know, they you know, don't give him anything that's going to make him look bad or anything like that. I don't think it would have lasted. If they're trying to book for this guy week to week and book for him like they're booking for everybody else, I don't think that would have worked out. It would have been far more damaging, I think, for that to happen. That would have been far more damaging to his legacy than anything else, having these people book for Stone Cold. They should stay as far away from Stone Cold as possible. Best thing that could have happened, I think, would have been for him to wrestle part-time and just do big matches and not be doing any sort of like week-to-week, month-to-month storyline stuff. Just come in for the big match at a WrestleMania or a SummerSlam. He missed out on a shit ton of money, too, by not doing that. So I'm sure... I would have to think, without asking him myself, I would have to think that he wishes it could have ended differently for him. And I know he got the last match with The Rock, and it was poetic in some ways, right? He went out at WrestleMania. There are worse ways for careers to end. Like Edge. Edge's last match, his last singles match, will go down as a world title win, a successful defense of his world heavyweight title at WrestleMania. Again, not a terrible way for your career to end. And so Austin going out, even though he lost, going out to The Rock at WrestleMania is not a bad thing. But believe me, Austin has to, you know, he has to think, man, if I could have gone another 5 years and just part-time and did big matches, I would have made so much money. He would have headlined so many more WrestleManias. You got to think that if there's one big regret, It's that he couldn't make that happen. John, I was a big fan of the larger-than-life face-painted characters like Ultimate Warrior, Sting, and the Road Warriors growing up. In today's more reality-based programming, do you think a character like that can succeed? Sure. Look at Finn Balor. Look at the Demon. We haven't seen the Demon since he came back, but the Demon stuff with the face paint always got over very well. So yeah, of course it can work. You know who might benefit from wearing some cool face paint, actually? I was just thinking about this. I saw the Gorillas of Destiny on the New Japan show last night, and I'm looking at Tama Tonga and all them. Roman Reigns. Like, Tama Tonga just makes it work in New Japan. He's got, like, kind of like a badass look to him. I think Roman could pull it off. Vince, in Okinawa, Japan, buy or sell on WWE bringing in Sexy Star as a surprise to end Asuka's undefeated streak. Oh, my God. No. No. Without mentioning Lucha Underground, WWE could introduce Sexy Star and explain that in Lucha Libre, she has wrestled and defeated male competitors. Plus, I think it would be an incredible match. Vince, I love you, brother, but I can't sell quick enough on that idea. Maybe they would have a good match. I don't know that I would go so far as to say incredible. But Sexy Star should not be ending Asuka's streak. I cannot get behind that. Andrew from Arizona. So earlier this week, James Hetfield finally reacted to Hogan's bullshit claim that he auditioned for Metallica to replace Cliff Burton. This would have been in 1986 at the height of Hulkamania. My question is, where does this rank on the list of whoppers told by Hogan? Well, to be fair, brother, Hogan was probably doing so much coke at the height of Hulkamania that he might actually think he really did audition for Metallica. So he might not think he's lying. He might actually think he's telling the truth. Now, Andrew sent me video of Hetfield's reaction to this. So you know, it was not earlier this week. The video is actually from December, but close enough. But yeah, first you have Lars Ulrich. Remember Lars Ulrich came out, he denied having even ever met Hulk Hogan. Now James Hetfield. I do like how Hogan's story has changed over the years. First, the story was that Lars reached out to him because they were buddies, even though Lars has no idea who he is. But the story was that Lars reached out to him about being in the group because I guess they were such close pals. And then in later years, in more recent years, the story has morphed into, you know, like, brother, I made tapes of myself and I sent them in, but I never heard back, Jack. So yeah, that's a good one. I would say that one is up there. That's near the top of the list. But so is the one about him turning down the script. Remember that? Three times he said no. They offered him the script to be Randy the Ram in The Wrestler, which the director has since come out and said is completely ridiculous. They never offered Hogan anything. But I still think my favorite, my personal favorite Hogan whopper is the one from his book. I think it was his book, where he claimed that he once worked close to 400 days in a single year. When you factor in the time zone difference with him flying back and forth to Japan. So, yeah, that one, I can't get over that one. That one to me is just, it's so Hogan. There's a whole list of these, by the way. There's the one where he claimed, it's not funny, but it is kind of funny, where there was a, I don't know if it was a Make-A-Wish kid or some kid with like a terminal illness of some kind. And Hogan's done a lot of work with kids over the years. I mean, absolutely nobody is denying that. But the claim was that like there was a terminally ill kid and he got him a ticket to watch him in the main event of SummerSlam in 92 at Wembley Stadium. And that when he was out there in the ring, Hogan looked out into the crowd at where the kid would be sitting, and he saw an empty seat, and he knew at that moment that the kid had passed away. And it's like, Hogan wasn't even at SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium. He wasn't even active in the company at the time. Let alone the fact that you're in a stadium with 80,000 people, so unless the kid is in the front row, where's he looking that he's going to see an empty seat just sitting there? But Hogan wasn't even there. So I don't know if that's just complete and total bullshit or if he's confusing SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium with Wembley Arena. I don't even know. There's been so many crazy Hogan tales over the years. But I will say this. I have to put Hogan over here for something he tweeted this week on Friday. He said, I guess he couldn't sleep, so he stayed up. He must have been on the network. He was watching 80s and 90s wrestling, he said, all night long. And he tweeted, he said, content was magical. I forgot how powerful and influential wrestling was back then. I didn't. I never forgot. And he's absolutely right. I'm with Hogan on that. Quazim from Manchester, England. My question is about the WWE tape library. I read online that in their library, there is a section with tapes labeled Do Not View, Copy, or Destroy. I have read that two of these tapes are the Owen Hart fall and Draws breaking his neck from the botched powerbomb. What other footage is there in that vault, and will we ever be able to see it? I'm not sure why you would want to see that stuff, so I hope not. Because if that ever gets publicly released, it's going to leak. It'll be all over YouTube and Daily Motion, and who the hell needs to see that? Okay, so as far as I'm concerned, that can stay under lock and key. You know what else they ought to put under lock and key? The last 2 years of Raw. They ought to put that in the vault, too. But I've read the same thing you did. I think the Owen Hart tape is in there. The Draws tape is in there. Beyond that, I don't know. Publicly, they haven't said exactly what's in there. I mean, maybe that famous Bret Hart-Tom McGee match that we've heard about from, like, 1986, where Bret made the guy look so good that Vince thought he had the next Hulk Hogan on his hands. He was all excited. And then he saw Tom McGee work matches against everybody not named Bret Hart, and he said, oops, I've made a big mistake. So maybe that match is in there. I mean, Colt Cabana, I think on his podcast many years ago, he told the story, because when you're in developmental, you can request a match. I don't know if it's just one, but you can request to see any match you want from their tape library, from their vault, and they'll give it to you. They'll give you a tape of it to watch. And he asked for that Bret Hart-Tom McGee match, and they wouldn't give it to him. So it's just this bizarre, it's just a match. Like, nothing terrible happened, but it's so bizarre. And you know it's got to be recorded somewhere, because I think even Bret Hart said that it is, at least as far as he knows. It's just so weird that that match, their first one, they may have had a second one. So if you ever find a Bret Hart-Tom McGee match online, that ain't it. That is definitely not the one. But that's always been a mystery to me about why, like, they put these DVDs out about, like, unreleased matches and stuff, and it's never ended up on there. They have another DVD coming out of, like, rare matches in a few months, and it's not on there either. Maybe one day we'll get to see it. Steven from Atlanta, GA. I was listening to a podcast that was discussing Ric Flair losing the world title to the Midnight Rider, Dusty Rhodes. But because Dusty refused to unmask, they returned the belt to Flair. Was it a rule that masked wrestlers could not hold titles? Why wouldn't Dusty unmask? I guess I don't know enough about the Midnight Rider character to know. Ah, yes, the Midnight Rider. What happened was, Dusty was banned. I don't remember if he lost a match, but he was banned for a while from, like, the Florida territory. So he came back, he reemerged under a mask, calling himself the Midnight Rider. And he would ride a horse to the ring. It was crazy. I believe that was a rule at the time, that a masked wrestler couldn't win a championship, which, if that's the case, that begs the question, then why would he even be given a championship match, right? Why would any masked wrestler be given a championship match if the rule is you can't win the championship, unless they just assume that you would unmask? But so that's weird. But yeah, he refused to unmask. Why he would refuse is obvious, because he wasn't supposed to be wrestling. He was supposed to be banned. And so the decision was reversed, and Flair got the belt back. Kaz from Bolton, England. My question is about the hardcore wrestler, the Messiah. Fortunately, and unfortunately, he says, in 2002, he was subject to a home invasion in which his thumb was cut off. I've read that this was because he slept with XPW owner Rob Black's wife, Lizzie Borden. Do you have any other information on this incident, and do you think he would have had a good run in WWE? I never watched XPW, so I never saw Messiah wrestle. I know what you know about the story. Two guys broke into his apartment, they took a pair of garden shears, and they cut off his thumb. I think they tried to cut off his dick, but he was able to fight them off. I know America's Most Wanted did a story about it many years ago on one of their episodes. You might be able to find it on YouTube. I don't believe they ever caught the guys who did it, but the belief was always that Rob Black, who ran XPW, was the one behind it, because Messiah allegedly slept with his wife. So I guess that was his revenge, which may have been why they tried to cut off his little Messiah. So I think Rob Black did go to prison many years later, but that was for something unrelated. Billy from Edison, New Jersey. What is your favorite band and favorite song of all time? Hall & Oates. See? That was an easy one. Daryl Hall and John Oates. I can't believe that Daryl Hall is 70 years old. That is insane. 70 years. I hope I look that good and have that much hair on my head when I hit 70, if I make it to 70. That's my hope. Favorite song of all time is Hall & Oates' song. It's Out of Touch. I've always loved that song ever since I was a kid. Adult Education is another favorite of mine. Say It Isn't So. Family Man, Private Eyes, Rich Girl. Hall & Oates is the shit, man. I'm telling you. Someone I worked with they just saw them in concert. I guess they must have been touring. I know they've been in concert for a while now, and I guess they must have been up around the Boston area. And he's not even like a particularly big fan of Hall & Oates or anything, but he went to the show with his wife, and he said they killed it. He's like, dude, do you ever go to a show? Because he knows I'm a fan. And I'm like, no. He's like, oh, you got to go. You got to find out if they're coming to New York. And it doesn't look like they're coming back to New York. They were just in Forest Hills, Queens. They were in New York like 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. But I remember when tickets first came out, I couldn't get any. They were all gone. So I think that looks like that might be their only New York stop. I'm pissed. I've never seen them in concert before. I've never seen them in concert. So one day, hopefully one day I can make that happen. It's funny though, you know, the story, I bet you don't know the story. The story about how the two of them came together is actually really funny for those of you who never heard it before. So at the time, Daryl Hall had his own band, I forgot the name of it, and John Oates had his own band, and they didn't know each other at all, but they each had a band. And so one night they're performing, it was somewhere in like Philly or Pittsburgh or someplace in Pennsylvania. They're out for a gig, and they're both on the bill to perform that night. Before they could go on, a gunfight breaks out. I think it was between rival frats, maybe, but gunfire just breaks out. And so Hall jumps in an elevator. He jumps in the freight elevator to get the hell out of there and not get shot. And John Oates happened to be in the elevator. So they start talking, and one thing leads to another, yada, yada, yada. Hall and Oates is born. It's a great story. A hail of gunfire brought the two of them together. How about that? Let's see here. Let's do one more non-wrestling question here. Devin from New Jersey, another Jersey boy. I think I've talked about enough wrestling. I like taking the non-wrestling questions every now and then. You've alluded a couple of times in your podcast that you watched The Sopranos. What were your thoughts on the show as a whole? Do you recommend it? And what were your thoughts on its polarizing ending? Yeah, you know, somebody in the Facebook group just gave me grief. They're like, oh, you know, Solomonster said Sopranos is like the best show of all time, even though he's never watched Game of Thrones before. Yeah, I've never watched Game of Thrones, and I've never watched The Wire. I probably should. But I never said The Sopranos was my favorite show or the best show of all time. I said it's one of the best. If I had to pick one, it would probably be either Breaking Bad or The Shield. That's me personally. But I would recommend, if you've never seen The Sopranos before, I would absolutely recommend it. It's fantastic. Does it follow certain stereotypes about Italian Americans? Yeah, probably. I mean, I could see some people being upset by that. But as a show, it's just, I don't know that there have been that many shows when I watched them at the time where there was this tension. Like, I always had this sense of dread. I probably just felt like you never knew when somebody was going to get whacked. But I always had this just sense of dread when I watch. And you think to yourself, why the hell am I watching this? Like, you should watch TV to get away from, like, stress and all the negativity and just enjoy it. But I would watch The Sopranos, I would watch Breaking Bad, I would watch The Shield, and I always had this sense of dread, like something bad could happen at any given moment. But it was just so good. I mean, the show, the way it was shot, I would absolutely recommend it. As far as the ending, I was not a fan of the ending. I've softened on it over the years. I was not a fan of it. I thought it was a cop-out. I thought my cable went out. That's what I thought. I thought when the screen went black, I thought, oh shit, my cable went out. And then the credits came up and I was like, oh, come on. Like, you can't end like this. So I was not a fan of the ending. Like I said, I've softened on it over the years. I guess I don't want to talk too much about it because if you're going to watch it, I don't want to give too much of it away. But I have my own theory about what it means and what really happened. But if you're thinking about it, if you've never seen The Sopranos before, I'm telling you, just go on YouTube and there's a shitload of Sopranos clips all over YouTube. Just watch some of the clips, even if you don't have the context of what's going on. If you're like thinking about watching the show, just watch a bunch of clips. I find myself sometimes on there, I'll watch one, and an hour later, I'm like, oh shit. I'm like still watching clips. So I would advise you to do that first, and if it looks like something you think you might be into, absolutely, man. Get HBO Go, and you have all the episodes there that you want. So we'll wrap up the mailbag right now. Keep emailing me your questions. Follow me on Twitter. @Solomonster is my handle. I hope everybody has... everybody stateside has themselves a very happy, very safe 4th of July, 241 years after our nation declared its independence. That's a long time. That's a pretty good run. It also happens to be the average length of an episode of Raw. But in any event, however you're celebrating, barbecues, fireworks, don't blow off any body parts, please. Stay safe. I will see you all back here next weekend for episode 503. We'll have great balls of fire predictions and a whole lot more next weekend. So until then, take care, guys. Happy 4th.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, wait, aren't you going to put any pants on? He just goes, no time for pants, and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. See, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now, for all you know. No time for pants.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.